Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The farmer in the dell, the farmer in the dell. Hi ho the derry-o, the farmer in the dell.
For over a century, black farmers have faced several forms of discrimination, from land dispossession to funding and resource disparity. The COVID-19 crisis serves as the latest reminder that within federal and local funding agencies, cropping fields may still be considered separate and unequal. Very little aid to farmers offered under the Federal CARES Act has been distributed to black farmers, and it served as a reminder of the country's long history of agricultural racism. Melody Hunter-Pillion joins me now. She's a public history doctoral student at North Carolina State University. Melody, welcome back to the show.
Yes, thank you for having me.
Also joining us is Kendrick Ransom. Kendrick is a fourth-generation organic farmer at Golden Organic Farm in Pine Tops, North Carolina. Hey, Kendrick.
Hey, what's up? How is it going today?
Good. Thanks so much for joining us. So, Melody, I want to start with you, and I want to kind of put this moment in context. Black farmers are struggling to receive adequate financial assistance right now during the pandemic, but this is just the latest tick in a long history of aid disparity. So take us back and remind us where we're coming from.
Yes, Anita, historical background is really essential to understanding the current status and challenges facing black farmers. So when we think about it, as we think of, you know, coming out of the Civil War and Reconstruction, what happens is in the South is black codes and Jim Crow. So you have Jim Crow infecting all areas of society, including the agriculture sector as well. So for black farmers, that means for many years, the USDA, their services were not equally available to assist those farmers with credit programs for purchasing land, perhaps from neighboring black farmers who might have been migrating to the North or the Midwest, not having credit programs so that they could purchase land from estate sales. And consequently, so many of those black farmers struggled to stay in business without equal opportunity to increase the scale of their farming operations. So if the onset of Jim Crow during the 1890s really dashed the hopes of many African Americans who hoped to not only farm for their own means and profit, but also to gain land. And even the USDA, as early as 1986, there's a wonderful report by Vera Black. It's called Black Farmers and Their Farms. And it is written by the U.S. Department of Agriculture. And she talks about the ways that sharecropping crippled black farmers for decades, with the majority of black farmers being landless tenants during the first half of the 20th century. And then if you move on to the New Deal, many scholars will call that, and black farmers too might say, it's the raw deal, because those same Jim Crow practices then allow local and state officials, and they are largely all white, to distribute those government services. So even though you have this Agriculture Adjustment Act of 1933 with the New Deal, those funds were really politically controlled in rural southern communities by whites who often, even without pretense, if we hear some of the anecdotal information even from the 1990s from black farmers, who without pretense are denying loans to farmers, who are making them wait, who are demanding that they show deference to them even if they come to ask for a loan. And so these are the things that we see through each of these periods in the country as we're experiencing a particular racial landscape. The black farmers are facing that same, those same things.
Yeah, you mentioned so many of these key points in history that kind of track these the trends along the way. And Kendrick, I'm curious, from your perspective, I mean, you grew up kind of learning this history and hearing these cautionary tales firsthand. Talk a bit about how that impacted you and your own decision to choose to farm.
Yeah, so when I first began my journey in agriculture and farming, it was exciting, but it was also frustrating as well. And it was a bit downgrading, as in people wanted me, they were excited about me farming, but they also just had so many traumatizing stories that was connected to agriculture and land in general. So it was kind of shaky, you know. I was kind of hesitant in which way I wanted to go, but you know, but just me being me, I was always stronger mentally, and I knew that I had to be the one that really get through it to display a larger picture, which is hope. You know, there's a lot of hope in agriculture and hope in farming. So that's kind of my take on it. I'm just very hopeful. I see the opportunities, the generational wealth that comes with the land, the healing, the therapy that our culture and our communities need, that we can get right there through agriculture, through soil, through animals. So I see it as power that we're reclaiming and our just culture, you know, which is knowledge and a lot of love at the same time. So it's kind of my beginning farmer's perspective of it.
Yeah. I mean, how about access to capital? You heard Melody mention kind of this historic repeated discrimination by the USDA. We know, obviously, starting a farm can be incredibly expensive, and being able to get a loan and get that startup capital is really important. What were you told at the beginning about loans and kind of who to borrow from?
Well, I was always told to stay away from loans. That's what certain loans with high APR rates and things like that don't really mean us any good, especially when it was at a point where we were getting loans based off of our land, you know, and the deeds and titles and things like that, collateral. So knowing that it was a risk of losing the land, losing our family values, I just had that programmed in my head to stay away from loans as possible. By me being an entrepreneur, I had some funds from other businesses that I ran, and I was able to use that. But a lot of farms are generally started by loans and big time loans. That's what keeps farms going. So I do know the importance of having that kind of assistance, the financial assistance, to really keep farmers afloat, especially when we're dealing with things like crop loss and your herds, death in your herds and things like that, insurance as well. So just knowing that the flip side of that, of how other farmers were able to benefit off loans, and certain farmers, black farmers, small scale farmers, weren't able to benefit from it, kind of left me uneasy.
Yeah. Well, Melody, how about that question of land loss? I mean, the statistics are staggering of black land loss over the past century, black farmland loss. Talk a bit about how that has impacted the state of black farming.
Yeah, so in 1920, there were almost a million black farmers, like 980,000. And so like one in every seven farmers in the United States, one in every seven was a black farmer. By 2017, the USDA census showed that black farmers made up like 1.3%, 1.4% of more than 3 million farmers. So you see, as you said, it is a staggering loss. But what I love is, and what I've heard from Kendrick today, is something I've heard from African-American farmers that I've done oral histories with in Brunswick County. There's this resilience and there's this resistance to this. And it's not new. There's been a resistance to this sort of thing, of this denial of land ownership, this denial of allowing black farmers to be cultivators, you know, respected cultivators of the land. And that's been going on ever since this discrimination started. And so I love hearing that from Kendrick. And another thing that he's saying that mirrors what I heard in Brunswick County is that black farmers usually are very leery now of loans, not just being denied them, but they're leery of debt. They don't want to be in debt to anybody. I see this as part of that resistance, too, and part of this trying to find ways to be resilient. And so it's interesting as I hear Kendrick talk about this today also. But I will also say very quickly that part of the resistance that we've seen over time has been in the courts. And, of course, in 1999, you have the major landmark Pigford versus Glickman, where the USDA, it has to settle with black farmers and has to admit this discrimination. And again, there was no pretense. Some of these officials openly admit that, yeah, this is what I did. And so that was a big suit in 1999, but many black farmers felt they were left out of that. And so there was a Pigford II that took place also. And I think that was in 2008, the Farm Bill allowed for those farmers to file a late file request. So some farmers did receive some funds from that. But I would say there's still a large number of farmers, you know, who have not received any assistance. And the just those historical implications over time have certainly taken a toll when we now come full circle back to those numbers of having so few African-American farmers in what I call it this heritage industry that's a large part of our not just Southern culture, but very North Carolina culture.
Well, and farming itself has changed. Obviously, farms, you know, there's been a huge kind of push for massive agriculture and systems that are set up to really support these large-scale productions. Kendrick, that is not the kind of farming production that your family is working with. So how has that shaped how you've been able to create revenue streams for yourself? Where do you all look, and how do you keep things financially viable?
I'm kind of on the wall with big ag. I do know I don't agree with a lot of their practices and the way they're structured, but I'm well aware of the final, like the big picture of how small farmers, we still need big scale farmers. Like, I believe we need to coexist a lot more. We should be on a more equitable level, but small family farms are just as important as these big corporations, because a lot of our small family farms can't feed the whole world, you know. And if we can use those big-time farmers to levitate their leverage and their resources to fund more small farmers, I feel like that would be a bigger impact on a national level, because it's a push and it's a pull, you know. A lot of these big farmers are pushing pesticides and things like that, non-GMO crops and things like that, while a lot of the small farmers are pushing organic. And it's just labor, you know. A lot of small farmers don't have labor in order to do that, you know, so they got to pull weeds by hand and use smaller equipment. Big farmers, they got more land to cover, so they're using pesticides to kill the crops. I mean, not the crops, but the insects and the weeds and things like that. So I definitely believe they need more funding for small farmers, and it should be on an equitable level between big ag and small farmers.
Well, that brings me to the pandemic and the way that federal pandemic relief was distributed. And a lot of it went to these bigger farms because of the kinds of crops that were listed, because of the way that the kinds of funding relationships you had to have to qualify. So, Melody, talk about pandemic funding and how much of it has gone to Black farmers.
Yeah, you know, I don't know the specific numbers, but I will say this, and again, I want to bring it back to history and even to what Kendrick was saying about the larger farms are, you know, quite often more favored by the federal government and funding, and have been historically. So again, we can even take this back to plantocracy, where, you know, you just have a certain class of people with very, very, very small percentage of the population in that class controlling wealth and power. And so I look at big farming as, you know, sort of mirroring that, you know, if we go along historical lines of what that looks like. But as Kendrick said, the small farmer, Black, white, Native American, what have you, women, Asian Americans now also, and Hispanics in North Carolina who might be starting farms, those small farms are definitely important. I will say this, when I checked in with Bob, the farmers in Brunswick County, who I interviewed about a year ago, just to ask how they were doing, and that was in April. So we were, you know, I guess you would say the early phases of the pandemic, and it was a problem for them because of shipping and how much shipping was needed at the time. They were transporting less, and I'll explain this. For Cleveland Simmons, this particular farmer, he has three sons who are farming, so great to see those young African-American farmers, but two of them were driving trucks to subsidize their farm income. So they just don't make enough working on the small farm. They have to supplement that income with some other type of occupation, so they're driving trucks. At the beginning of the pandemic, they were literally transporting less product for their clients because it just wasn't needed or wasn't possible at the time. And so that really was an economic pinch for them in what's already a tight market.
Yeah.
tight market and historically marginalized also for Black farmers and fishermen. So, quite honestly, I really need to check in with them again and to see how they're doing now. I know they had planted wheat and were about to plant corn, and that was in April, and I would really be curious to see what their crops were like.
Kendrick, how has the pandemic influenced your family's farm and your ability to run your operation?
It has affected us. We took a loss in market sales. We lost maybe about 800 pounds a week in sales that was going out. So it definitely affected us on an economic level, as well as our community. On a community level, we weren't able to really interact with our community and host a lot of volunteer events and community events like we normally do. So really just separated us a lot. We had to convert into a more virtual online kind of form. Instead of doing more of the farmers market, we switched over to an online database and more so with our CSA programs. We did find a lot of light throughout the pandemic. We just done a lot of cleansing and got ourselves together and really realized like it's going to be dependent on us. So we just kind of like stepped up to the plate and realized like we're just not going to keep settling for pennies and dimes, and we're going to create our own, you know, we're going to market our own, grow our own, and sell our own and support our own. So it's just really been focusing around that, but it's just really been a scare, you know. My garden manager, she's well over 60 years old. So she's been, you know, they've been throwing around that health disparities phrase, and she's really been cautious about coming out to the farm. So we've been low on labor help with labor. She takes care of her mom. She's also a school bus teacher, so she was really being conscious of her health, you know, even though we're outside, we're working and socially distanced. It just created more barriers inside of our communities while we're also dealing with the biggest barrier, which is our food system. So we're dealing with COVID-19 now on top of dealing with a poisoned food system. So it's kind of like, should we stop working on rebuilding our food system and just focus on COVID-19, or should we do both? So it's just really been a push and pull. We've had it's been a disconnect from our community as well as our market. So it's been tough. And I grew a lot of my plants at the high school where we have a program where we help with the FFA programs. I was no longer able to grow my plants in the greenhouse because schools were shut down. So it's these politics behind COVID, you know, and the language behind it is frightful to our communities. And I try to influence leaders to realize if you consider yourself a leader, you should shape the voice and the connotations of your language, you know, because we say some things that and it just triggers certain people a certain way. And by being a leader, you need to have that kind of diversity on your team so you can know which words you can and should not say. So it's been a real, real shaky era with this COVID-19, but we're still here and we're pushing through.
Kendrick Ransom is a fourth-generation organic farmer at Golden Organic Farm in Pine Tops, North Carolina. Kendrick, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Also with us was Melody Hunter-Pillion, a public history doctoral student at North Carolina State University. Melody, thanks.
Medical apartheid, the dark history of medical experimentation on Black Americans from colonial times to the present.
People of color have been disproportionately impacted by the coronavirus. They're more likely to have frontline jobs that expose them to it and more likely to have the underlying conditions that make COVID-19 worse. But the racism embedded in the healthcare system might also play a role. From member station KQED in San Francisco, April Demboski reports that some hospital systems are trying to fix that.
Back in March, Carla Monterroso went hiking in Utah with some friends. She flew home through the Las Vegas airport, and 4 days later, she started feeling sick.
I had a full, bad, dry cough. It was like my lungs felt really sticky, and my fevers were ridiculous. 100.4, 101.2, 101.7, 102.3, I believe.
She kneeled in the shower on all fours, ice cold water on her back, willing her fever to go down.
That night, I had written down in a journal letters to everyone, like, in case I died.
She was sick for another month. Then came a new batch of symptoms.
A headache all
headaches.
I had shooting pains in my
and
legs.
And sharp pain in her legs and abdomen.
I had seen so many of the reports of people having strokes around my age range about blood clots and being really afraid of that.
Still, she wasn't sure if she should go to the hospital.
As like women of color, you get questioned a lot about your emotions and the truth of your physical state. You get called an exaggerator a lot throughout the course of your life.
It took four friends to convince her that she needed to call 911. But when she got to Alameda Hospital, her worst fears were validated.
The doctor came in and said, "I don't think that much is happening here. I think we can send you home."
Carla had a couple friends on the phone to help her, and they started asking questions. What about Carla's high heart rate, her low oxygen levels? Her lips are blue.
And he was like, "I'm not doing this."
He walked out of the room.
You know, he comes in, he wants to talk about my friend's tone and like my tone.
Carla said she didn't want to talk about her tone. She wanted to talk about her health care. She was worried about blood clots in her leg, and she asked for a CT scan.
And he was like, "Well, you know, the CT scan is radiation right next to your breast tissue. Do you want to get breast cancer?"
He didn't order the test. At nearly every turn, Carla says her concerns were dismissed. Her cycling oxygen levels, the machine's wrong. The shooting pain in her leg, probably just a cyst. Carla just wanted to get out of there. Her friends picked her up and drove her to UC San Francisco.
And one of the nurses came in and she was like, "I heard about your ordeal. I just want you to know that I believe you. And we are not going to let you go until we know that you are safe to go." And I started bawling. Because that's all you want, right? Is to be believed. And you spend so much of the process not believing yourself. And then to like not be believed when you go in. It's really hard to be questioned in that way.
A series of tests at UC San Francisco ruled out a blood clot. Carla went home stabilized, but rattled. Alameda Health System declined to comment on Carla's experience. She believes that what happened to her helps explain why people of color are faring so badly in the pandemic.
Because when we go and seek care, if we are advocating for ourselves, we can be treated as insubordinate. And if we are not advocating for ourselves, we can be treated as invisible.
Experts say this happens frequently and regardless of the doctor's intentions or race. For example, Carla's doctor was not white. Dr. Renee Salazar is the assistant dean for diversity at the University of Texas at Austin Medical School. He says research shows every doctor, every human being, has biases they're not aware of.
Do I question a white man in a suit who's coming in looking like he's a professional when he asks for payments versus a black man?
Unconscious bias most often surfaces in high-stress environments, like emergency rooms, where doctors have to make quick, high-stake decisions. Add in a deadly new virus where the science is changing by the day, and things can spiral.
There's just so much uncertainty.
Now serving 1-3-7 at station number 4.
At Kaiser Permanente Health System, Dr. Ronald Copeland is working to improve this. He says in the early days, doctors resisted training.
It was viewed almost from a punishment standpoint. Doc, your patients of this persuasion don't like you, and you got to do something about it. And it's like you're a bad doctor, and so your punishment is you have to go get training.
These days, Kaiser's approach is rooted in data from patient surveys. Now, these questionnaires don't ask if you think your doctor was racist, but they do ask if you felt respected.
Trust building, empathy.
If the communication was good.
Communication effectiveness.
Kaiser then breaks this data down by demographics to see if maybe a doctor gets good scores on respect and empathy from white patients, but not black patients.
If you see a pattern evolving around a certain group and it's a persistent pattern, then that tells you there's something that from a culture or from an ethnicity, from a gender, something that group has in common that you're not addressing. Then the real work starts.
Copeland says when you reframe the goal of training around getting better patient outcomes, doctors want to do it.
Folks don't flinch about it. They talk about it and they're eager to learn more about it, particularly about how you mitigate it.
Carla Monteroso is glad that training is happening, but says it needs to be more widespread. Carla is the CEO of a nonprofit for racial equity in tech, and she says even for her, it took an army of friends and activists fighting for her just to be heard.
90% of the people that are going to come through a hospital are not going to have what I have to fight that. And if I don't say what's happening, then people with much less resources are going to come into this experience, and they're going to die.
It's been nearly 6 months since Carla first got sick, and she's still not feeling well. She recently moved to L.A. so she could be near her family for her recovery. For NPR News, I'm April Domboski in Oakland.
Facebook, Facebook, gotta check my Facebook, gotta take another look.
Facebook said today it is banning all content that denies or distorts the Holocaust. That is a big reversal. CEO Mark Zuckerberg has long said the social network is a place for free speech, even if that speech is offensive. NPR tech correspondent Shannon Bond is on the line with us now to offer more details. And we should note that Facebook is among NPR's financial supporters. Hey, Shannon.
Hey, Elsa.
So tell us a little more about this new policy. I mean, how did Zuckerberg's thinking on this change?
Yeah, so to understand that, we should go back to 2018. He gave this interview to Recode, and he said that while he personally finds Holocaust denial deeply offensive, he said Facebook shouldn't take these posts down just because they're factually wrong. Here's what he told them.
I just don't think that it is the right thing to say we are going to take someone off the platform if they get things wrong, even multiple times.
And really, the way that Zuckerberg frames this, you know, it's his idea is Facebook is a place for people to exercise free speech, and the company shouldn't be the arbiter of truth. He says that over and over. This approach, of course, has caused a lot of controversy and criticism. Zuckerberg even had to go back and clarify he wasn't defending Holocaust deniers. So today, in a Facebook post, Zuckerberg now says his thinking has, quote, evolved over how his company handles Holocaust denial and that balance between free speech and harm.
Interesting. Well, what about the timing of this policy change? I mean, why is Facebook taking action now, you think?
Well, Facebook says this is, you know, really about what's happening in the world. They point to data showing a global increase in anti-Semitic violence. They also reference this study of younger Americans that showed almost a quarter say the Holocaust is a myth or exaggerated or they're unsure about it. They say that's an alarming level of ignorance. And there's external pressure. This summer, a group called the Conference on Jewish Material Claims Against Germany organized a social media campaign. Here's one of the videos it put out. And you can hear Holocaust survivors pleading with Zuckerberg.
Mark Zuckerberg removed the Holocaust deniers from Facebook.
No, there is no denying it. The Holocaust was real. I know.
You know, we've been talking about this so much this year. Facebook is just under all of this pressure to stop hate speech of any kind. Of course, it can be really difficult to remove bad content, especially when it can go viral so quickly among billions of users. And Facebook has acknowledged this new policy will take some time to enforce effectively. It has to train its artificial intelligence technology to recognize and stamp out these false claims.
Right. Well, what are critics of Facebook saying about this particular change?
Well, across the board, and I would say, you know, this has really been welcomed by critics, and many of them are saying this is a really big step. This is a big deal for Facebook to do it, even if it is belated, because, of course, many of these groups have been telling Facebook for years that Holocaust denial is a huge problem. And in just the past few weeks, Facebook has been cracking down more on harmful content. It banned QAnon, the baseless conspiracy theory that really took off this year, has been so popular on Facebook. It prohibited anti-Semitic stereotypes, banned armed militia groups. I spoke with Jonathan Greenblatt. He's the CEO of the Anti-Defamation League, and he's part of a coalition behind a campaign this summer to boycott Facebook advertising.
Facebook will be judged not on the promises they make, but on how they keep those promises.
And, you know, and this is something that people say all, to me all the time. You know, Greenblatt here is saying Facebook is listening to its critics. It's doing the right thing. That's important. The real question, though, is how will they enforce all these rules?
That is NPR tech correspondent Shannon Bond. Thank you, Shannon.
Thanks, Elsa.
Don't know me no more, but they'll does the good outweigh the bad? And the only way that that's going to happen is if we have general guidelines in terms of, do we wear seatbelts in AI? How do we regulate?
We have over 600 cameras in the city of St. Louis. We've spent up to $100K a pop on different surveillance technologies, $4 million in the past 3 years. And we've done it without any real audit or understanding of how the data is being used. Are they being used ethically?
The ethical questions surrounding artificial intelligence are huge.
And the problem currently is most of the technologists are gobbled up by the big tech companies. So if you're working at Facebook on face recognition, you've got an NDA and you can't be a part of these discussions.
I'm Sarah Fenske. This is St. Louis on the Air. The ethics surrounding this technology and the questions regulators will need to address are a big topic at the Prepare 2020 conference now underway in St. Louis. It's hosted by Prepare.ai. They're a nonprofit based right here. Now, this year, the conference is virtual, and that means you can join from anywhere. It takes place throughout the month. The issues it's grappling with are ones Tinus LaRue has thought about a lot. He's the founder and CEO of FanCam, and he moved to St. Louis more than a year ago to help facilitate the company's new focus, which involves artificial intelligence. And he joins us today. Tinus, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Sarah. It's great to join.
So tell us a bit about FanCam. What was the original idea for this company?
Well, it started about 10 years ago, my business partner and I figured out how to take really high-resolution images. So being sports nuts, we took it to a big local rugby game and used the cameras to capture the crowd.
Mm-hmm.
And so when it took us about 4 days to put this image together, but when we did, it went completely viral. So much so that we started getting emails from all around the world. Sports teams saying, please come take pictures of our crowds.
Hmm.
So from there, we jumped on a plane and started a business. And that business, because we were the first to do it, we were lucky enough to be invited to capture the Super Bowl, Daytona 500, most of the U2 shows, Taylor Swift shows, Stanley Cup final, and a number of events around the world. So that's the origin story. And then the computer vision and artificial intelligence part came a bit later. But I think you had a question.
Yeah, and actually that question was going to be, so where did you end up taking that? I understand that having a great photo of yourself and your friends having fun at a stadium, there's some great joy in that. But you started to realize this technology could be used for even more than just a fun souvenir.
So that's exactly it. So about 5 years in, and having to look at fan photos for a living, we started picking up that these crowds were different. We'd capture like two college football games, both sold out. But as the game started, one would be half the seats would be empty and the other would be full. So I started wondering, why is that? Is it because their tailgating is so popular, or is it because traffic is a problem? And so we realized that, yes, we're giving the fans this cool digital memento, but maybe there's some interesting data in looking at these crowds as a whole. So being a lazy engineer, I thought instead of me just counting seats, couldn't we train computers to do that for us?
Hmm.
And so the answer is you can. And that's how we got introduced to this whole world of artificial intelligence and computer vision. So fast forward that 5 years later, we've now trained computers to look at these crowds and to help teams understand their fans a bit better, understand when they're leaving their seats, what merchandise are they wearing, and some example we're working on now is how many people are wearing masks and how close are they together, so we can create a safe environment for sports fans to return.
And so this is something where the camera doesn't just capture these people, it's also able to provide some analysis of maybe who they are and what they're doing.
Not who they are. That's a very good question. So as I went into this world, and that's why I'm speaking at Prepare on the ethics of facial recognition, because we had to learn a lot about the difference between face detection and face analysis and recognition and AI and these things. And these things are different. So what we do, we don't touch facial recognition. It's ethically it's dubious. In fact, I'm passionately against the use of facial recognition in public spaces.
Hmm.
But what we do is use computer vision to analyze these images for more generalized data. So go back to the example of the empty seats. That is something that doesn't require facial recognition. It's actually object recognition. What we do there is we actually count the empty seats more so than analyze the faces. But you can go further. You can train computers to say, well, tell me not just how many fans are in the building, but what's the male-female distribution? Because teams want to know that. They want to know if their efforts to reach female fans are actually effective.
So you don't care that I, Sarah Fenske, am in the crowd. Why would anybody care about that? The team might be interested, though, in my demographics. It might allow them to market the advertising in the stadium to me better, or it might allow them to figure out why I keep leaving my seat. A middle-aged woman is bored, something like that.
Or she's in the sun, or whatever. Or she's always joined by other women of her age, or she's bringing a family member, stats like that. The teams want to create a place that fans enjoy. And so if the team thinks that the average age is 55, they're going to play the wrong music because the crowd's age may be 25. So it's things like that. But the technology itself can't identify you.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also, even if they could, Google knows you're there and Apple knows you're there. There really isn't any business model in trying to identify fans.
Yeah, that does make sense. And as Tina said, I don't want to forget to mention this Prepare conference. They're going to be going more in depth on this issue. They have a panel about social impact and ethical implications involving artificial intelligence. That is on Wednesday, October 28th. They also have a session coming up on October 21st that focuses on AI at work and at home. You can find more information about that conference on our website. That's stlpublicradio.org. And I also want to introduce a second voice into our conversation today. She's somebody who has some thoughts on this subject, both on the possibilities here and some of the peril that can come with it, as Tinas will be discussing on his panel in a couple weeks. And Sarah Baker is the policy director of the ACLU of Missouri. Sarah, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Sarah. Great to be here.
So some of this technology, I mean, it seems amazing, like the fact that the Cardinals could now have a sense of, yes, our fans are precisely 52% male and 48% female or vice versa. That seems like something that's useful for the Cardinals to know. Where does it cross the line into something where it begins to give you some qualms?
Yeah, I think Tina alluded to this a bit earlier. It's when those ethical implications come into play, and particularly when they collide with constitutional obligations and the right to privacy that we have in our country. And I think, you know, in the way in which many technologies are being used, on the surface, the purpose is benign, and even for having fun and for expanding technology and improving human life. But the other implication of that is, what rights are we willing to sacrifice in order to engage with those technologies? And that centers really on your right to privacy, and if you are consenting to being surveilled or not, and how that data is being used on the back end as well.
Do you see a difference in my right to privacy, say, if I'm on a public street, say I'm walking down Market, or if I'm there at a game where I've paid to be there and I'm putting myself in a place where, frankly, a sports journalist might capture me rooting for a fan? I might be captured on the what are those big things called? You guys know what
the
I'm talking
Jumbotron.
About. The Jumbotrons. Do I have a right to privacy in that environment?
Yeah, you have different zones of privacy, certainly, under the U.S. Constitution. And I think what most people would want to experience is being able to consent, right, to when you're being surveilled and when you're not being surveilled. And, for example, not the technology that we're discussing today, because, as I understand it, the current technology that Tinas is using doesn't involve facial recognition. But technologies that do involve facial recognition can be really intrusive into private spheres. In fact, the city of St. Louis, just this past summer, allowed persistent surveillance technology systems to take a greater role in our city, meaning that we're going to investigate what a partnership looks like with them. And that could involve surveillance of the entire city. And in fact, in Baltimore, that means that 90% of outdoor activities are surveilled. And I think we're getting into a point where we need to make sure that we're having robust conversations like this when we're putting our privacy rights on the line, because I think we have a shared value around wanting to keep some aspects of our lives private to ourselves.
The wheels on the bus go round and round, all
what is Joe Biden's record on race? The Democrat makes it a big part of his case for election. He wants to heal the divisions of President Trump's time. He's a white man who served under the first black president.
Damn you, Obama.
Yet he is also criticized for parts of his record. His future running mate, Senator Kamala Harris, pressed him last year about busing to integrate schools.
Do you agree today that you were wrong to oppose busing in America then?
No.
Do you agree?
I did not oppose busing in America. What I opposed is busing ordered by the Department of Education. That's what I oppose.
Over the next two mornings, we will explore two portions of Biden's record, starting with his opposition to busing. That story is relevant to the way he would govern today, even though it stretches back decades to the start of his career.
I'm Joe Biden, and I'm a candidate for the United States Senate.
This radio ad from 1972 promotes Biden's first Senate campaign in Delaware.
Politicians have done such a job on the people that the people don't believe them anymore, and I'd like a shot at changing that.
He was young and liberal, against the Vietnam War, and for civil rights. Activist B.B. Coker met Biden when he joined civil rights protests in Delaware.
And Joe came barreling by and saw us, jumped out the car. Somebody give me a sign. He never had his own, and you can tell him, well, he knows it because I've told him, he never had his own protest sign. He always had to get somebody else's sign.
But on one issue, Biden parted from most civil rights leaders, school busing, sending black kids to white schools, and sometimes the reverse.
By the time Biden gets to the Senate in 1973, the issue of busing usually emerges as a very contentious hot-button political issue.
Matthew Delmont wrote a book called Why Busing Failed. The Supreme Court outlawed segregated schools with its Brown v. Board of Education ruling in 1954. The decades-long struggle to enforce that ruling started in the Deep South. Later it moved north, where schools were not legally segregated, but neighborhoods effectively were segregated. Judges ordered busing to diversify neighborhood schools. Why did white parents have a problem with this?
The most basic answer is white parents weren't enthusiastic about having their kids attend racially integrated schools. Sometimes that was linked to explicit racism. More often, these white parents understood that because of policy decisions that had been made over decades, black and Latino schools had fewer resources. They tended to have less qualified teachers. It was controversial because there just wasn't a lot of support for this happening in their own neighborhoods.
When you research this, do you find a lot of people who are saying, I consider myself a liberal, I favor integration, just not this way?
Absolutely, and I think that's what this history reveals. So it was a classic liberal position to say, you know, I'm in favor of school integration in Little Rock, in Montgomery and Selma, but not so much in Boston, Chicago, New York, or Wilmington.
In Wilmington, demands for integration led a judge to order busing starting in 1978. In the NPR archives, we found recordings of a white Wilmington parent who said that year that he wouldn't go along.
I have one child that is supposed to be bused but will not be bused. Worst comes to worst, I see nothing wrong with the education in the home program.
A black parent supported busing, but she noticed black kids had to ride buses more than white kids did.
So I figured, okay, here we go again with the business of crumbs from the table. But I've always told my children that if you stand there long enough and get enough crumbs, you finally get the whole cake.
And for the first time, the anti-busing forces were joined by half a dozen liberal senators.
A 1975 NPR story on busing featured Senator Joe Biden. He said busing wasn't working. In this recording, the senator said liberals needed to speak up, even if that made them awkward allies of segregationists.
It has been an issue that has been in the hands of the racist, and we liberals have out of hand rejected it because if George Wallace is for it, it must be bad. And so we haven't really looked at it. Now there's a confluence of streams. There is academic ferment against it, not majority, but academic ferment against it. There are young blacks and young white leaders against it. There is social unrest, which highlights it.
Biden would later speak proudly of his pragmatic efforts to work with everyone, even segregationists. But his 1970s stance on busing drew criticism from the only black senator then, Republican Edward Brooke.
He can be against busing, but can he be against the Constitution as a liberal? I mean, can he be against the law?
Historian Matthew Delmont says Biden sought legislation to limit busing within the Constitution.
In his own words, it was a huge deal. I think he said it was his most important issue in the late 1970s and early 1980s.
Studies eventually showed busing helped black students without harming white students, but it never grew popular, and Biden's allies in Wilmington note that some black parents never liked it either.
Your kids were bused then?
They had to be, because of the law.
Biden's longtime friend, Bebe Coker, says she urged him to push instead for fair housing laws.
We had a very small group that opposed busing, and I welcomed the opportunity to share with you housing was segregated. You went to school where you lived.
Matthew Delmont says Biden did favor fair housing.
So he sees school integration as only one part of a much larger policy dynamic. And here I think he is right, that I think if we're going to have meaningful school integration, you have to also attack housing discrimination, try to get more public housing in the suburbs. I think one of the caveats I would add, though, is that those things need to work together. You can't say you're in favor of housing integration and not also be fighting for school integration at the same time.
A person close to Biden insists even today that his stance was right. The unpopular practice faded. But there's a little more to the story.
Yes, I accept your nomination to run and serve with Barack Obama.
Biden's service under the first black president offered a second chance at school desegregation. Matthew Delmont says the Obama administration tried methods that were more subtle than busing, like grants for local schools to voluntarily strengthen their own diversity plans.
These weren't massive revolutionary type initiatives, but they did try to get the federal government back behind the idea of school integration as a good, as a public good.
Does the Obama administration approach suggest that Biden was right, at least about the politics? Busing was going to be a non-starter. They had to come up with other ways to encourage integration.
Once you sort of narrowed the political vision to that extreme, then yes, what the Obama administration was trying to do was relatively beneficial given all the things that were already off the table for what politicians were no longer willing to do.
Generations after integration became the law, many white students and most students of color attend schools that are still effectively segregated. But if Biden wins in November, his administration could try again.
The school system is in need of a reckoning around whether we are actually a country that believes in the moral and legal mandate of the Brown versus Board decision, or we're not.
As President, Joe Biden would face a challenge the country has struggled with even longer than he's been in politics.
When you don't vote, you can't sit on a jury. You have no right to complain about the police because you won't even go and vote so you can even sit on a jury. As I've told, said to the cows when I first started to call in, I spent 11 years on a job where I worked for a bank and had to sit in court day after day, day after day after day. And I watched them select juries. I watched black people going to jail, black people having white probation officers, and the whole judicial system just truncated with white supremacy. And a great deal of it is some of it could be lesson if black people simply voted.
Florida was supposed to see hundreds of thousands of formerly banned voters at the polls this election. 2 years ago, voters there approved restoring voting rights to people with past felony convictions, nearly 1.5 million of them. But Republicans in the state legislature hobbled the initiative by requiring anyone with a felony conviction to completely pay off their fines before casting any ballots. Our next guest, Desmond Mead, calls that a poll tax. He's the president of the Florida Rights Restoration Coalition, and he joins us now. Welcome.
Lulu, how you doing this morning?
I'm doing very well. How are you?
I can't complain too much. You know, it's been very busy. However,
yes,
you know, I'm enjoying this work more and more each day.
Well, let's talk about your work, but let's start with your journey. You know what it's like firsthand to have your vote restricted.
Oh, yes. You know, I think last month was the first time that I voted in over 30 years. I was a person that suffered through substance abuse, and I've been, you know, convicted of felony offenses before. I've served time in jail and in prison.
How did it feel when you cast that vote?
It was an amazing feeling. Voting is more than just valuable. It's sacred. It says that I am. It says that I'm an American citizen. It says that my voice matters and it counts. And so many people who have put their lives on the line, and my ancestors who are hung on trees and burned and bitten by dogs, and they went through all of that just so I could have that moment that I had last month.
You worked on getting that 2018 law passed. It's been a long road, but here we are in 2020. How many people in Florida could vote but haven't paid off their fees after the legislature did what they did?
Well, Lulu, let me tell you. When we passed Amendment 4, we cleared a pathway for 1.4 million returning citizens to be able to vote again without having to grovel at the feet of any politician. Unfortunately, because of the legislation that was passed, you know, about 774,000 have some type of outstanding legal financial obligations that they have to satisfy before being able to register to vote. However, that still leaves anywhere between 500,000 to 600,000 returning citizens that can register immediately, and some of them have.
You call this, though, a poll tax. Can you explain why?
Well, let me tell you, I've changed my approach on that. I think it goes beyond the poll tax. I think it's a clear affront against democracy, forcing an American citizen to choose between putting food on their table or voting. To me, that is not what democracy is all about. Access to the ballot box should be unencumbered and free. And any attempt to minimize that or to discourage that is an affront to democracy and what this country stands for.
Do you think that Amendment 4, that 2018 initiative, will have an impact on the results of the election next month?
Oh, most definitely it will. And let me be clear. Amendment 4 accomplished what it set out to do, and no amount of legislation will stop that. You know, prior to Amendment 4 passing, American citizens living in Florida lost the right to vote for life if they were ever convicted of a felony offense. And so Amendment 4 created that alternative pathway. And so that still remains true today. You know, we see about maybe half of the people that have outstanding fines and fees. But, you know, we always look at obstacles as opportunities. And that's exactly how we've approached this situation. And we've raised over $25 million to help people pay off their fines and fees so they can participate in democracy. We estimate that over 40,000 people have helped through this program. And in addition, there's so many returning citizens that have registered to vote on their own because they didn't have these obstacles. And so we are very confident that, you know, returning citizens, people who benefited from Amendment 4, will have a significant impact on this election. I mean, this is a state where a presidential election was decided by less than 600 votes. And so we believe, yes, we will have an impact. The voices of people who've been impacted by the criminal justice system will finally be heard.
That's Desmond Mead, president of the Florida Rights Restoration Coalition. He's also the author of the new book called Let My People Vote. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Lulu, for having me on.
The individuals in custody are suspected to have attempted to identify the home addresses of law enforcement officers in order to target them, made threats of violence intended to instigate a civil war, and engaged in planning and training for an operation to attack the Capitol building of Michigan and to kidnap government officials, including the governor of Michigan.
That was Michigan Attorney General Dana Nessel speaking last Thursday. Last week, more than a dozen white men linked to an anti-government right-wing militia were arrested after plotting to kidnap Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer and overthrow the Michigan state government. And the arrests are just the latest example of the growing threat of militia extremism across the United States. While federal law enforcement officials say they consider these groups to be a major threat to domestic security, the Trump administration has shown no signs of condemning these groups so far. Here's Governor Whitmer from her press conference last week.
Stand back and stand by, he told them.
Hate groups heard the president's words not as a rebuke, but as a rallying cry, as a call to action.
For more on the latest from Michigan, I'm bringing in Dustin Dwyer, a reporter with Michigan Radio. Welcome to the show, Dustin.
Thank you for having me.
What extremist militia groups are these 13 men affiliated with?
Well, according to the charges, they were affiliated with the group they called the Wolverine Watchmen. That was a group that seems to have been created by this group of men because they didn't really fit into any of the other groups. I spoke to one militia leader from a militia called the Michigan Home Guard, and one of the ringleaders of this group who's now been charged with terrorism and kidnapping, he was in the Michigan Home Guard and got kicked out because his views were too extreme. He was too aggressive, and he was thought to be an unstable person. And so he got kicked out of the Michigan Home Guard and then linked up with these other men and created the Wolverine Watchmen.
Dustin, how common are these militia groups in the state of Michigan?
They're very common, and they have been for years. There are many different militias, and people in the militias in Michigan have been trying over the past week to sort of distinguish between this group and that group. You know, you have groups in some militias coming out with statements condemning these 13 men, but the militias are really all over the state in Michigan.
What exactly is the distinction that these other militia groups are trying to make here? I mean, these are obviously, these are, from my understanding, these are folks who have deputized themselves to somehow mimic law enforcement in many ways, but they are not officially deputized by anybody to actually carry out any of the things that they say they want to do. So what exactly are these groups trying to distinguish? How are they trying to distinguish themselves?
Well, when you talk to them, so the way they explain it to me, and again, I talked to the leader of the Michigan Home Guard, and he said, look, we're really just about protecting our family. We're about arming ourselves to protect our family. And they say, you know, we're here to help the community. They talk about giving out water in Flint and responding when the dam collapsed. And they see themselves as sort of these private citizens who go out to help. Meanwhile, they're just carrying these, you know, really large guns as they do so. So in their minds, at least, there's a big distinction, and they've been trying to draw that distinction since this all happened. In reality, what a lot of people on the outside see is, you know, these huge rallies that were happening at the Michigan Capitol. All these people were mixed together, side by side. I mean, the people who have now been charged with terrorism were standing side by side with these other people in the other militias who say, you know, they're the good guys.
What happens now, Dustin, to these folks? These are 13 white men, I believe, who were arrested in this plot to overthrow the Michigan government and also to kidnap Governor Whitmer. What happens to them now?
Well, all 13 men are in custody. Six of them are facing federal charges. Seven of them are facing state charges. There are hearings on Tuesday, preliminary hearings for some of them, and they will be in custody, you know, pending whether they get bonded out or something like that. But now it's a court case. It's you know, they're facing some pretty heavy charges here.
Among those charges, I mean, how much time could we see these folks doing if they are, in fact, convicted of the charges?
I think it depends on the charge, but terrorism charges, they could be serving a long time in prison. But, of course, their lawyers will come out and say, you know, not all 13 were the ringleaders here. Some of them had different roles in this plot, and they, of course, will try to negotiate it down. But we'll have to see.
Tell me a little bit about what the sense is in Michigan among the folks that you're talking to, you know, everyday Michiganders. How are they seeing what's been playing out?
I think everyone's been shocked by it here as well as, you know, anywhere else. It's shocking, but in certain ways, almost surprising, because for some people it confirms what they already believed. As I said, there were these demonstrations in April and again in May where a lot of people were shouting things and holding signs that said nearly the same things that that has been charged in these documents. I mean, there was one man walking around the Lansing State Capitol with a doll with dark hair, which looks like our governor, and there was a noose around its neck. So some of the imagery and some of the rhetoric doesn't seem surprising at all. But when you look at the details of how far they got in this plot, it's pretty shocking.
Dustin Dwyer is a reporter with Michigan Radio. Dustin, thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you.
Gusty Renegade context of white supremacy. So the next segment is from The Current. It is a Canadian podcast. They do news. It's a serious news segment. So they're doing a report on the U.S. presidential election, and this segment is about Breonna Taylor, victim of white supremacy, black female in Kentucky, killed by suspected race soldiers. Now, they are connecting her killing with the Kentucky Derby. I'll let you hear the segment, but I am preceding that segment. This is Oliver Stone doing audio commentary from his movie JFK, where there's a scene where they're getting information about the assassination of Kennedy at a horse race track, and he gives a little bit more detail about that. That came to mind when I heard this segment, as well as the general tendency to dehumanize black people and associate us with animals. But this is Oliver Stone, and then The Current on Breonna Taylor, the U.S. presidential election.
One commentator from Oxford wrote something about that. It was a very interesting comparison he drew for me to something I wasn't aware of, but this scene grows intense between the coffee, the legs of the horse. He made me think of the racetrack scene in Nixon. And again, the linkage between the horse, the eyes of the horse like a beast, the hooves, the innocence of it, compared to Hoover's face and the beast again. So horses twice now, it's funny, figured in these patterns in these two political movies, you know, the horse race concept of life, which is pretty brutal.
We are in the home stretch of the U.S. election. 15 million Americans have already cast their ballots in what's been an unprecedented race for the White House. Here at The Current, we have been tracking our way down the Mississippi River in our modest radio RV, speaking with Americans about the stakes in this election. We're calling the series Road to November, and today we're in the Derby State.
Secretary throws his head a bit. Under off. They're at the head of the stretch, and Cham is the leader. He leads it by a length. Secretariat is in the center of the racetrack and driving. At the wire, it's going to be Secretariat. He wins it by 2 lengths. Cham is second.
Kentucky Derby is one of the most famous sporting events in the whole world. Horses like Secretariat, American Pharoah, Seattle Slough are, for many people, household names. This year was unique. First, COVID-19 pushed the Derby from May through September. And then, by the time the horses were lining up in the starting gate, the world was watching Kentucky for a very different reason. Breonna Taylor's death in a police shooting has spurred protests around the world for months. In her hometown of Louisville, demonstrations continue almost daily. And on Derby Day, Black Lives Matter protesters clashed with counter-protesters in front of the Derby's home, Churchill Downs.
No justice!
No Derby!
No justice!
No Derby!
No justice!
No Derby!
Those protests left Greg Harbutt facing a dilemma. Greg Harbutt is one of the few black horse owners in Derby history, and he was excited about his horse, Necker Island, running that race.
As you can see, they have pretty big teeth and they're pretty sharp, so that's just a way for them to file the teeth down. They do get dental care, like humans, but in the meantime, a lot of them, you know, eat out of boredom or just something to do or chew on things. Well, right now we're looking at Necker Island. One of the first things you want to do is look in the horse's eye. If a horse has a dull eye or a dull coat, that usually tells you something's going on, either with their blood count, maybe them not taking in as much feed as they normally would, things of that nature. After that, you want to look at the weight to see how the horse is carrying its flesh. Does it have the typical weight that it would normally carry? And then you want to look at the horse's energy. After you have a horse for a while, you start to begin to recognize its disposition. Necker Island, for instance, is a horse that's usually very happy. He likes to bite, things of that nature. But, you know, he's a typical coat. He can be a little bit rambunctious, and he does have some spunk, but I think that's what makes him a great racehorse.
Greg Harbutt was asked to boycott the Kentucky Derby and have that horse, Necker Island, sit out the race in solidarity with Black Lives Matter protesters. Greg joins me now from Lexington, Kentucky. Greg, good morning.
Good morning, Matt. How are you?
I'm well, thanks. Thanks for joining us. Take me back to those days around the Derby. You have the regular pre-race jitters, but what other kind of pressure were you feeling around that time?
Well, I mean, you know, the Derby is, it's one of the most famous races in the world, but certainly the most famous race in North America. So to be a participant has been a lifelong dream of mine. Anyone involved in the industry wants to be able to say that they participated in the Kentucky Derby. And for me to have family lineage with my grandfather, who had a horse in the 1962 Kentucky Derby, just made this year's experience a mix of emotions.
You were asked, as I mentioned, to boycott the Derby this year in solidarity with Black Lives Matter and out of respect for Breonna Taylor. When you got those calls, how did you feel? How did you react?
I own Necker Allen with two other partners, Ray Daniels and a gentleman by the name of Wayne Scher. And Ray and I can certainly understand the sentiments from those individuals who called us. We stand with the Black Lives Matter movement, and we stood in justice for Breonna Taylor, as we still are optimistic that some things will come about. But, you know, it wasn't as simple as just them asking us to set out of this race. I mean, this is a race that happens once a year out of 25 to 30,000 foals born every year. Only 20 line up in the starting gate. The industry that we love to participate in is not the most diverse or inclusive industry. And we felt that by participating, we were bringing awareness of the contributions that African Americans have come before us and contributed to the industry. It gave us a platform to bring awareness of those contributions, as well as bring awareness in our own right with Breonna Taylor. And for us, you know, we felt that us being there was progress. And, you know, we can't mix up progress with protests.
Was that a tough decision for you to make?
It was because, as stated, we certainly stand for justice for Breonna Taylor. And our heart was with the protesters as well as the people calling for justice. Mm. But, you know, at the same time, my grandfather, who owned the horse in the 1962 Kentucky Derby, was unable to attend or be listed as an owner because of the social injustice and racial segregation at that time. So it was certainly something that played in the back of our minds. But, you know, Ray and I set out strategically a while back to bring more minorities into this business and bring awareness of the contributions that African Americans have made. So,
you mentioned the emotions, and you talked a little bit about your grandfather. I mean, what's your family history with this race and with horse racing?
I'm a third-generation horseman. My great-grandfather, Will Harbert, gained a lot of notoriety as the groom for Man of War. Many people consider Man of War to be the greatest racehorse of all times. And he and that horse had a very unique, special relationship. Over a million people came to see Man of War. My grandfather, he gave a very eloquent monologue that became very famous. My grandfather, Tom Harbert, was a very well-noted horseman in his era, working with some of the leading thoroughbreds of his time, as well as some of the leading owners in that era.
You talked about diversity and inclusivity. I mean, horse racing is described as one of the whitest sports in America. Has that sport changed much since your grandfather was running horses?
Unfortunately, it has not changed. In fact, you could almost echo that it's gotten worse. There's just not a lot of minority representation in any capacity, whether it be ownership, trainers, or jockeys. When you look at the jockey standings, out of the top 100, there's only three representatives of minority African-American descent. You look at the top 100 trainers, there's no representation whatsoever. So there's a lot of work that needs to be done within the industry to address these issues, to overcome some of these biases. Sometimes they're unconscious, sometimes they're, blatant biases. But there's work to be done. The great thing is, since our participation in the Kentucky Derby, a lot of individuals have reached out. We're certainly dedicated to the work that needs to be done, and it looks like, as a whole, many of the industry leaders are committed and want to discuss what can be done to change these things.
How are you greeted? I mean, when you walk through the stables and the paddocks, how are you greeted?
You know, for the most part, I'm greeted with a lot of respect and treated very fairly, but I would be naive to believe that there aren't certain individuals with unconscious biases due to my race or ethnicity that wouldn't have issues with me being in the position that I'm in.
And do those come out? I mean, have people said things to you? How has that presented itself?
I've never had anyone to say anything directly to me blatantly, but there certainly are subtle things, that happen on a day in and day out basis. A couple months ago, we had a very prominent owner and breeder, Tom Van Meter, that made national news with his comments referencing African Americans with racial slurs and calling us animals. So, there certainly are some individuals within the industry that echo some of those same sentiments that Tom Van Meter does.
You don't need me to tell you that these are tricky, intense times in your country. And we've been speaking with voters from Minneapolis to St. Louis for the past few weeks about this election. When you take a look at the election, what strikes you about the moment that you're in right now?
Well, I think as a whole, this country is in some very turbulent times. I think this is going to be a very pivotal election for many reasons. And I think that this election will be very significant in the way that the country turns for the future. So I, as well as others, eagerly anticipate the results come November.
What's at stake, do you think?
I think a lot's at stake in this election, being the how America will be perceived and the direction that America will go, I think, will be on the line in this upcoming election. I think this is going to be an election that has significant monumental history impacts and one that we will talk about for the foreseeable future in history books, no matter which way it goes.
Where do you find hope in this moment?
I find hope in the American people that as a society and as Americans, we would do what's right by all Americans, not just a certain sector group of Americans. So I find great comfort in believing in that. I think this is a great country. I think this is a country just built on values, and I would hope that we would exercise the values of the majority of us have come election time.
And when you say do what's right, just finally, what does that mean, what's right?
To be a society that stands for all individuals. I think that's what's right. I don't think it's a political party thing. I don't think it's a Democrat or Republican thing. I think it's something that we are charged to do as Americans.
What do you think your grandfather would have made of the fact that you had a horse in the Kentucky Derby?
I think he'd be very delighted. I think he would be a mix of emotions knowing that he was unable to attend in 1962. And here in 2020, he had a grandson that was able to achieve that and be able to participate fully as an owner. I think he would be very proud if he was here to be able to see that.
It's a real pleasure to talk to you, Greg. Thanks for your time this morning.
Right, we talk about Rekia Boyd in Chicago, which we should because that sister was killed unjustly. But we don't talk about Antonio Cross because that was the black man the cop was trying to shoot when he accidentally killed Rekia Boyd. So what we have here are deaths of black people, but it's not based on the kind of identity politics that we keep hearing on Twitter and the media, et cetera. It's built on the fact that they're coming in to get black men and that black women are the collateral damage of that type of state and private citizen violence. So if we're going to analyze anti-black violence and death, we have to understand that there is a male ontology behind it that's endangering not only the lives of these young black men and these black boys, but it's also endangering our sisters, our mothers, and everyone else that's around us.
Welcome back to CBS This Morning. We have an exclusive interview with Breonna Taylor's boyfriend. His name is Kenneth Walker. Now, he was with Taylor when she was killed by Louisville police officers on March 13th. He told us that they were in bed watching a movie when police raided the apartment as part of a narcotics investigation that was targeting her ex-boyfriend. We should point out that Kenneth Walker and Breonna Taylor do not have a criminal history and no illegal drugs were found in that home. We went to Louisville over the weekend to talk with Kenneth Walker about that night.
To the world, it's just a hashtag, a picture, and all of that. But to me, it was much more. More than a girlfriend, too. I think that's what I want the world to know the most. That was my best friend. The most important person, pretty much, to me on Earth. And they took her.
Let's go back to that day. What kind of day was it for you two?
It was a normal day. It was a relaxed day. Really just chilling and just being us. You know, we went on a date, went out to eat, went back in the house, playing, you know, watching a movie.
Take us to that moment when your life really changed forever.
There was a loud bang at the door. You know, nobody was responding. We were saying, who is it?
You all did ask, who is it?
Several times. Several times, both of us. You know, there was no response.
You know, the police say that they said several times, it's the police.
If they knock on the door and say who it was, we can hear them. It's dead silent. I know 1,000,000% sure that nobody identified themselves.
So the next thing you hear, the door flies off the hinges. Are you feeling afraid?
Definitely afraid. But I don't have much room to be afraid because I got somebody here that I got to take care of.
So you hear the heavy knocking, and what do you do?
So now at that point, we're getting up to put on clothes, make ourselves decent to answer the door. Then I grab my gun.
We should also say you were licensed to carry the gun.
For sure. That was the one time I had to use it. I mean, if it was the police at the door and they just said we're the police, me or Brianna didn't have a reason at all not to open the door and see what they wanted.
So the doors fly off the hinges.
I let out one shot, and, you know, I'm figuring if somebody's trying to break in or something, they're not going to want to do anything after that.
And after that, what happens?
You know, I don't think I ever heard so many gunshots, like, all at the same time. I've never been to war, but I assume that's what war probably sounds like.
One officer fired 6 shots, Officer Mattingly. Officer Cosgrove fired 16 shots. Officer Hankinson fired 10 shots. That is a lot of firepower.
I still try to make sense of it to this day. There was definitely nowhere to hide. There's bullets coming in every direction.
When did you realize that Brianna had been shot?
I guess in the middle of all the gunfire, like, she screamed. But, like, I was holding her hand.
You were, like, holding her hand?
Yeah, like, while this was happening, I pulled her down to the ground. But, you know, she was just scared, so she just didn't get down.
So in the middle of all of this, you realize that she's been hit. Was she alive at the time?
She was still, and when all the gunfire stopped, she was, like, bleeding and stuff, and I was holding her. You know, then that's when I called my mom.
You called your mom first?
Yeah, I told her that somebody just kicked in the door and shot Brianna, and she's freaking out at this point, but she told me to call 911, so I did.
911, Operator Harris, where is your emergency?
I don't know what's happening. Somebody kicked in the door and shot my girlfriend.
While you're on the phone, you don't know it's the police.
I didn't know it was the police, not at all, and I even proceeded to tell 911 that, you know, somebody just kicked in the door and shot my girlfriend, you know. If I knew who it was, I would have said the police. Oh, I wouldn't have been calling the police on the police. Like, that doesn't even make sense.
Where was she shot at?
I don't know. She's on the grill right now. I don't know.
Is she alert and able to talk to you?
No, she's not. Breathe. God.
In the midst of me talking to 911, I'm like, well, Brianna's mama should know about this, too. I hung up on them, and I called her mom.
The police didn't come rushing in?
Not at all. I don't think I realized that it was the police until I was on the phone with Brianna's mom. I hear, like, people outside talking. I thought they was, you know, coming for help because I called 911.
So you think they're coming to help you?
Yes. So when I come outside, there's guns pointed at me. You know, I'm being threatened with dogs and whatever else.
Put your hands on your head.
The officer asked me, was I hit by any bullets? I said no. He said that's unfortunate. So that threw me off too. So I'm like, what's he mean by that?
That's unfortunate, he said to you, after mm-hmm. you've just lost your girlfriend and you don't know what is happening. What did you think when
and
he said that?
I didn't know what to think.
Wow! Yo, drama, hold up, sir. Hold on. Stop the motherfucking record.
All right.
I want you to Pondy replay, drama. Pondy replay.
Just give him one more chance, man. Run that shit the fuck back.
The officer asked me, was I hit by any bullets? I said, no. He said, that's unfortunate. So that threw me off, too. So I'm like, what's he mean by that?
That's unfortunate, he said to you, after mm-hmm. you've just lost your girlfriend and you don't know what is happening. What did you think when
and
he said that?
I didn't know what to think, and I really wasn't worried about me. The only reason I'm even out here is because the only way for her to get help in there is for me to be out here.
We were scared. Walk. No, we didn't know who it was.
Walk.
We didn't even know who it was.
And I was in the back of the car. I don't know. I got drugged all the way down the street. It was cold. It was wet. I didn't want any socks and shoes on gravel, rocks, and everything. And they were just dragging me like I had scabs and stuff on my feet from that.
When they take you to the police station, still no socks and shoes.
Still no socks and shoes. When we finally left the scene, we pulled over in like a random parking lot on Manslick, which is the street, like at the bottom of the hill down the street from Rihanna's apartment. And another officer in an unmarked car, and he wasn't in uniform and stuff, and he came to my window. But his tone was way different than everybody else's who was just on the scene.
How so? Different how?
He told me that this was a misunderstanding, and we're going to get to the bottom of it, and asking me, did I need anything? Did I need water and this and that?
Hey, partner, can I get your name? Dennis Loftus, Matt, there was a little bit of miscommunication. I wanted to talk to you before they left.
And then when I got to the police headquarters or whatever it was, they took the handcuffs off of me and everything. I was walking around. I went to the bathroom.
Go ahead. When you get there, you can take the handcuffs off.
So clearly y'all know something's wrong. Because you don't...
You're allowed to move freely.
Yeah, you don't allegedly shoot a police officer, and they take the handcuffs off you.
Were you surprised to hear that you were accused of shooting a police officer?
I definitely was surprised. But I was more concerned about, is he okay, and is Brianna okay? At this point, I still didn't even know if she was alive or not.
So when did officers tell you you were going to be charged with attempted murder? When did you hear that?
Maybe like 5 or 6 in the morning that same night.
What did you think?
I was worried about if Brianna was okay or not.
When were you finally told that Brianna didn't make it?
I never really got told, like, directly. I saw it on the news.
That's how you heard Breonna Taylor died? On the news?
Pretty much. And I was in the cell, and it was, like, on the news, and it said one, you know, female dead. It confirmed it. You know, I didn't know for sure what condition, you know, she was in when I left. So I didn't know what they did, but as these body cam videos are still coming out, I see they did nothing. Clearly, we see the SWAT team in there, and she was still in there. They're still, like, casing the apartment with her laying right there on the ground.
Apartment's full. We're now crime scene. Let's go ahead and move out. All right? She's done.
Disrespectful.
Do you think if you would not survive this incident that we would be hearing the story that we're hearing today? If you had not survived it?
Definitely not. There wouldn't be a story. You probably wouldn't even know about it. If I didn't live, you probably wouldn't even know about Breonna Taylor
or Kenny Walker.
Or Kenny Walker. I don't want everybody to know about Kenny Walker at all. As long as everybody knows Breonna Taylor.
And what do you want us to know about Breonna Taylor?
Just, she would have did anything for anybody. She took care of a lot of people. There's a lot of people that need her bad right now. Including me.
Boy. Wow.
A grand jury accepted the Kentucky Attorney General's recommendation not to charge any officers for Breonna Taylor's death. Both the Louisville Metro Police Department and attorneys for 3 individual officers involved declined our request for interviews or for comment. I mean, I'm very struck. Kenny Walker, you can still see, is shattered. He's still in a lot of pain. I think this interview was very difficult for him. That night they were watching a movie called Freedom Riders, and he went to watch it again. And he said he still gets triggered by songs, movies,
sure,
certain types of food.
Yeah.
And I think it's so important to discuss, to stress, no criminal record.
Yep.
It was the first time that he's ever fired his gun when he wasn't on the shooting range. And to this day, he goes, I'm not really even sure I hit the police officer. They told me I did, but I'm not really even sure about that.
I think everybody in America should watch that piece because they think they may have an idea of what happened. This will change your perspective. And I think it comes down to accountability. And proportional use of force.
Yes.
This is a legal Kentucky gun owner who fired one shot into what he thought was an intruder.
Mm-hmm.
He got 20-plus bullets from multiple people on the outside who couldn't see what was happening.
Yeah.
That's not proportionate.
And it's totally dark in the apartment. That was interesting, too, about calling 911. He said, why would I call 911 if I thought it was the police?
Well, and clearly by what he says to 911, he doesn't understand what's happened.
Yeah.
And, I mean, that's the really compelling part, too, is the way he was treated there and the way he then the different way he was treated at the police station.
Exactly right.
Do other police officers think that was a disciplined response to Kenneth Walker's single shot? I think that's a question I'd like
it's
to have.
It's a lot of questions. And we've got more of the interview with Kenneth Walker in our next Next hour, we'll have more of what he says, including his reaction to the nationwide protest over Breonna Taylor's death. As he said, you know, to a lot of people, she's a hashtag, not to him, and how he is handling his grief.
You know, first ladies usually have a cause, and you've already said you're interested in speaking out against bullying on social media.
I think it's very important because a lot of children and teenagers are getting hurt, and we need to teach them how to talk to each other, how to treat each other, and to be able to connect with each other on the right way.
It's an ironic choice, since her own husband sent out a stream of pretty nasty tweets during the campaign.
It's been in the comments sections, it's been in emails or in letters. When it's directly to your face and it's this close to your face, it's a whole other jarring experience.
The second lady of Pennsylvania, Giselle McFederman, went to the grocery store last night and says that she left shaking and in tears. And now she's talking about the social media video that captured a woman using a racial slur against her.
KDK's Megan Schiller live now to explain why she's turning this into a teaching lesson for her children. Megan.
The second lady said she loves the kiwis that go on sale here at Aldi. She didn't want to bother her security detail for a quick 10-minute trip to the store, so she came here alone. But what she said happened inside and then later spilled out into this parking lot left her both shaking and speechless.
Second Lady Giselle Fetterman remembers the feeling all too well.
I was quickly a 9-year-old undocumented little girl, scared of someone knocking at the door. At that moment, it absolutely brought back all the feelings of feeling that I didn't belong or that I wasn't welcomed here.
An innocent trip to the grocery store ended with this. Just moments before, Fetterman said the taunts and racial slurs started inside.
She says, you know, there's that N-word that Fetterman married and said I was a thief and I didn't belong here and then kept walking.
Fetterman paid and ran out to her car.
I got in my car and I began to back up and I'm crying and shaking by this point. And she comes out of the store with no groceries, just with her purse. And that's when I was finally able to get my phone, and that was like kind of the end of it.
The end of the verbal assault, but the start of a conversation.
You know, words are really powerful and they're really painful. And I think I just want people to keep that in mind. She had to learn that behavior, right? So someone taught her that, whether that was her, whoever raised her, taught her that at some point. And we have to be responsible to break these cycles.
A reminder that it's never too late to unlearn.
And I ask that she be met with compassion, and that if you know her, if she's your neighbor, if she's your family member, to try to find where this came from and try to work to the same way we learn something, we can unlearn it.
I did reach out to state police. I am told that Pennsylvania state troopers on the governor's detail are now handling this incident. Reporting live tonight, Megan Schiller, KDK News.
This is dedicated to Louis Mackinson.
Once he was close enough to my cousin is when he hit him across the face and he wasn't even aware that there was a weapon. His teeth fell into his hand and he fell to the ground.
Investigators with the Monroe County Sheriff believe 18-year-old Devin Freelon was the target of a racially motivated attack by this man, 42-year-old Lee James Mowat. It happened Saturday evening in the parking lot of Sterling State Park near Monroe. And according to Devin's family, this photo from Snapchat shows the suspect holding what appears to be the weapon, some sort of bike chain with a lock on it. Investigators say Lee Mowat yelled racial slurs and may have been upset over some music.
He seen my cousin passing him in a parking lot. He was quick to try and approach him while screaming racial slurs at him, and he had the weapon behind his back.
Devin Freelon!
When do we want
justice?
When do we want it?
Now!
This afternoon in the heart of downtown Monroe, a protest in support of Devin Freelon, organized by one of his teachers at Orchard Center High School.
Given everything going on in our country right now, this was necessary.
He graduates in 4 days, and he has to do it with missing teeth and a broken jaw.
Five, four, three.
She's pure alligator. Pure white.
Two. Albinos that do make it to reproductive age can't find a mate because they look funny.
One. Albino affairs.
Now to this promoted story. Windsor Essex boasts a wide variety of species, including some rare animals only found here. However, even some very common animals, can have rare conditions that make them that much more special. That's what happened to our Rich Garten, who made a sighting of a rare animal in his own backyard. That's where we find Rich at the moment.
Jim, I was sitting in my yard on Monday afternoon when I saw a fluffy white critter scampering up a nearby tree. And at first, I'll have to admit, I thought it was a cat. But upon closer inspection, turns out it was an albino raccoon. Nestled high in the tree cover of Oakwood Conservation Area, a very rare sight.
We don't see them very often, so getting one in your backyard, such as this one, this raccoon, is it's pretty exciting.
Karen Cedar, the City of Windsor's naturalist, confirms the raccoon has a condition called albinism, lacking the traditional black and gray coloring and trademark bandit strip across the eyes. She says it's a genetic mutation caused by an absence of melanin, which provides color to the skin, fur, and eyes. According to Skedaddle Wildlife, a raccoon has a 1 in 10,000 chance of being born with albinism. Your chances of seeing one is even lower, 1 in 750,000, the same odds as getting struck by lightning. South Windsor residents were eager to catch a glimpse of the elusive animal.
Just seeing it casually live its life in our backyard, something that I'm so familiar with, is just awesome.
28 years. Never seen an albino raccoon ever. It's like, I still can't believe it.
Once you realize that how extremely rare it is to see one of these things, it really makes you like grateful and like appreciate it and just admire it more.
Unfortunately, the albino raccoon doesn't enjoy the same life expectancy as their fully colored counterparts. Their lack of skin pigmentation makes it difficult to make use of the sun's rays to warm up their bodies.
They're extremely conspicuous. So in terms of hiding for predators, protecting themselves with camouflage, those are not options that white animals have. They are very exposed. They're very easily seen by predators, so it's a much riskier life for them. I would enjoy it while it lasts, because it might not last very long.
Melanie Coulter of the Windsor-Essex County Humane Society says the rare animal is great to experience from afar, but recommends onlookers avoid getting too close, as all raccoons can carry diseases like rabies and distemper. Cedar says Windsor-Essex boasts a wide variety of species and recommends people document these unique sightings.
It's so important to look out in your backyard, because you just never know what might be hanging out there.
Aside from raccoons, Cedar says it's peak bird migration season and encourages everyone to get out, put COVID-19 aside for a few minutes, and enjoy the nature around them. Jim, I should add, Cedar classified this albino as the most unique backyard sighting of 2020.
I can understand why at first you might have thought it was a cat. Most interesting, Rich Garten tonight. Thank you.
Context of white supremacy. The albino coon, the sighting of 2020 in the year of the Rona, the albino coon. Man, Gusty Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Saturday, October 17, 2020. So I have been told. They said the report about the albino coon, that was a promoted story. I thought, promoted by whom? And promoted why? Is there a product associated with albino coons? Like, do they have albino coon slippers? Or what product is paired with albino coons? Did you know it's squirrel month? In fact, to make sure I get that in too, October is squirrel month. It is Negro History Month across the pond in the UK, but
But here in the U.S., October is National Squirrel Month. Did you know that? That's coons. They're right there. So albino coons and all the rest, right on. National Squirrel Month. But I don't know why that would be a promoted story. If anybody has any thoughts, unless that's connected to the system of white supremacy, who would be in the business of promoting what they call a feel-good story about a albino critter? This is the weekly compensatory call-in. Albino Affairs. We could not have 2020 without Albino Affairs, and now we've had it back for consecutive weeks. So last week we had Lucky, the albino squirrel, and then this week, the albino coon. Compensatory call-in, the number to dial is 720-716-7300, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Number again, 720-716-7300, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Many things to share before we get to the callers. Let's see. For one, for the first time I think ever, I said for years, even some folks have heard me say it years ago and they repeated it back to me years after I said it. I was like, yep, that's correct. Every year I don't have to watch the NBA finals. I know what's going to happen when it gets to the end. A white man is going to hand that gold ball to another white man. Welsing moment there for sure. That didn't happen this year. We got the Rona, so you don't do a whole lot of touching. But if it had gone the normal route, it would have been a white man handing the ball to a white woman. Talk about patriarchy and sexism, don't they? Call it women and minorities. That's what they said in CASE. Women and minorities. Yeah, and remember, it was Jeannie Buss, suspected race soldier, owner of the Lakers. They were the ones who got a loan when they were handing out Rona dollars to try to save businesses. It was the Los Angeles Lakers, billion-dollar franchise, before they got the championship. Where did we get disaster relief? Signed right up to get their money. But it didn't happen this year for the first time, I believe, ever. White man to a white woman. And she even said, I was taught by my father, you step back and just let the players enjoy. So she didn't even step forward to get the trophy. She let all the black people run and grab the gold ball. The white woman. Refinement. Continuing. I was not going to play the report about Breonna Taylor, the CBS report. I intended to play the report about the Kentucky Derby that was from The Current, a Canadian news segment. I intended to play that. I did not intend to play that CBS segment. That was why the audio clips were a little bit longer. I already had the segments that I wanted to play. I already had the sequencing and everything together and was about 75% of the way complete. And total disclosure, I was making my morning smoothie. Had one of my folks on Facebook ask, where are the smoothies? I haven't seen any smoothie pictures in a while. And I have smoothies so often, I don't take pictures of them, you know, every day when I make a smoothie. So I go down to make my smoothie, which was amazing. Beets, cherries, blueberries. Whew, amazing. One of the best of the week. Macadamia nut milk. Oh, absolutely amazing. So I'm going down to have my smoothie, and I'm listening to the news while I'm making my smoothie. I'm listening to the CBS report about Breonna Taylor. They're interviewing her care mate, we'll say. So there talking to Mr. Walker, and I think about the first 6 minutes. I'm still not going to play this report. I've told you all for years I'm not into all the police shootings of black people and all the rest of it. Like, Okay, so I'm just listening. It's interesting. I'll be a little bit more informed. Okay. I think it was he got to the point where he said, so the police have broken. She's been shot. I didn't know it was enforcement officials. I'm calling 911. I think they're here to help us. And then they have the guns out and the dogs. When they put the dogs in and they let the track play so that you can hear how prevalent, how central the dogs were in this attack. So they shot and killed this black female in her own residence. And then we bring in the dogs to further terrorize. She may have still been alive at that point to not get medical attention or what have you. To have a dog who is looking to finish you off, bite through your jugular and all the rest of it. Like, wow. That was where I stopped. Oh, okay. We have been. Timing. I had not heard those details about the Breonna Taylor report at any point during the year. I had not heard those details. Maybe all that just came out, but wow, in a very tragic and painful way, context of white supremacy, our timing has just been flawless throughout 2020. In fact, we just had the report last week where they were talking about that specifically. Generations of white dogs being used by enforcement officers to attack black people and maim them for life. I mean, he was, think about that. You want to say he was fortunate. The dogs literally could have finished them off. She's dead, and especially you fired at a police officer, it could have, we got a wayward nigger, go ahead, chomp him to death. In a very tragic manner. Flawless timing. You should go back and listen to Dr. Tyler Perry. That was in July. Remain Gary, white dog, in my top 10. Regrettably, like, no cheering about that, but wow, you will get a much better understanding for events like that if you read Romaine Gary, white dog, or the hounds, the slave hounds of the Americas, Dr. Tyler Perry. That's another good one. Whew. Impeccable timing this year. Also, would not have had access to that report that I did not intend to play. I would not have had access to that report if investors had not pitched in to replace Gusty's computers. I got one of my MacBook Pros replaced this week. I used it to broadcast the Neutralizing Workplace Racism segment for yesterday. I'm not using it right now, although it's operating, sitting right there. My previous computer that it's that is about to permanently stop functioning. It is working for the moment, so I thought I will use it today just because it is working. But whew, I am elated and substantially less stressed having my computer replaced. As I said, the goal is just to replace both of them, and I think we're right there to be able to replace both of them. I am going to wait a little bit just to make sure that this is what I want, and I will be satisfied to get the exact same thing. But enormous gratitude to all of the investors who made it possible to promptly replace my computer. I said last week I've been having all kinds of Wi-Fi problems at my residence, my modem. Worst year ever, so both of my computers failed, and the modem at my residence, not all on the same day, but basically all at the same time this summer. So in addition to having two computers that were about to fail permanently, I did not have Wi-Fi at the residence. So it has just been absolutely worst year ever, challenging in many, many respects. But I mentioned the modem last week and got that replaced immediately from my wish list. I was amazed at how promptly it arrived. I was, in fact, able to go and get the Wi-Fi service upgraded to get even better service. So I now have the best Wi-Fi at my residence that I've ever had in the history of Cal's Broadcasting, and the best computer I've ever had. I was very pleased with my MacBook Pro. I'm still using it now, the one that I got in 2010. I'm only mentioning this, not, as I said before, I'm always very ambivalent at minimum, if not out and out opposed to like brand mentioning, because I'm not like a paid spokesperson for Apple. I'm not on Tim Cook's staff. Like Steve Jobs and I were not homies. We didn't kick it when he was here in the physical form, suspected race soldier Steve Jobs. But the MacBook Pro that I'm using now, I've been using for a decade. All of the, like, literally, I've probably done well over 1,000 Cal's programs using this program. Durable, dependable, works well. The upgrade, wow. Like, I have been absolutely amazed at how much better the newer computers are. Like, they are super, super fast. Like, again, I'm only mentioning this because, what's that word that I used? You heard Lakers owner Jeannie Buss? She didn't rush forward to grab the trophy? Oh, no, no, no. Dwight, you go get it. You all, congratulations. You made Kobe proud. You go do it. The white woman is refined. White people refine everything. You don't just come out and have the exact same MacBook Pro that you had in 2010 and 2020. You don't have the exact same type of white supremacy racism that you had in 2010 that you have in 2020. You refine. And you can't be ignorant about computers, MacBook Pros, and make refinements. You can't be ignorant about racism, white supremacy, and make refinements. But wow, the refinements are extraordinary. I'm stunned. I can only say again, learn a little bit about everything. Perhaps if I had known how much how many improvements they had made over the years to a MacBook Pro, maybe I would have been a little bit more motivated to see if I could get my computer replaced sooner. But things happened as they did. Wow. Absolutely amazing, the upgrades that they have made over the years. Stunning. You're supposed to refine and improve our understanding of counter-racism, just like white people refine and improve their dedication and practice of white supremacy racism. Whew. Much obliged for the computer. I hope we are worthy of the time and energy and not talking foolishness here on the Cows. And it definitely should be no excuse now for tardy downloads or uploads, because this is the best Wi-Fi I have ever had at my residence in the history of the Cows. Let's see. Next. Oh my goodness, the computer, this is the last point. This is not a metaphor, because I've mentioned both of these incidents before. Just when I got the computer, I was reminded. Even before I got my new computer, when I had the MacBook Pro that I've had for the last 2 years, when I have been out in public with my Mac, I am treated slightly better by racist white supremacists. I'm still a coon. I'm not treated as well as the albino coon. Make sure don't be mistaken. I'm treated a little bit better, and I can be specific. And it's equivalent to when I had non-white male. I had to dog sit for him for about 2 months, and I had his little Yorkie Terrier. This is like a little 7-pound dog. It is almost exactly the same. Racists, racist children, racist women, racist men would see me in public, not say a word to me, maybe call me a coon, whatever it is, try to run me over with their car, or I'm just not there at all, whatever it's going to be. When I had that dog, and or the times I've been out in public with my MacBook Pro, oh my goodness, look at that dog. Oh, he's so amazing. Way more courteous communication. Not even, like I said, I'm still a coon. Just look at the dog the coon has. Oh my goodness, it's amazing. They wouldn't even speak to me. Same thing with the MacBook Pro. I would have people who would speak to me, white people, who would stop and speak. And, oh, my goodness, that's such an amazing computer. That type of thing. It reminded me of that exactly this week. I was so impressed. I was like, oh, that's why white people treat me slightly better. In fact, I think some of them are even amazed. Like, how did that coon get a MacBook Pro? I don't even have a MacBook Pro. Did you steal that? Like, I feel like that's been the response at some level sometimes. Anyway, next. They had that segment about Holocaust denial and Mark Zuckerberg. They're not going to tolerate Holocaust denial, as they call it, on Facebook. And I found that interesting for so many reasons. Is the same going to apply for white supremacy racism? So if you deny that there's a system in place right now mistreating black people, is that also in the same rubric? Like, what specifically counts as so-called Holocaust denial? Lots. Is there any other form of speech that is going to be prohibited if you deny or say that this doesn't exist and it actually did? Anything else? Always interesting. Like I said, they took our Facebook page down just for posting a news report about the mayor in Missouri, Mayor Lucas, being threatened with being hung for encouraging citizens to wear masks. Same type of thing with Governor Whitmore, except I don't think they plotted to kill him, or excuse me, kidnap Mayor Lucas. They just wanted him to be lynched publicly for, you know, having the audacity to tell us to wear a mask. Let's see. They, in the segment where they discussed presidential candidate Joe Biden, who I suspect is going to lose, I've said that for years now, I think, right? And folks can get their comments in since we're about 2 weeks away if people think I'm in error or whatever they think is going to happen, but I think I've been pretty resolute about that. The segment they were talking about his views on busing, I thought it was important. It sounded like what I would expect from race soldiers. B.B. Coker, who sounded like it was a black female, I could be in error, this was all audio, but she spoke and she said they were doing the protests and what have you, and about the busing, so-called school integration segregation, totally incorrect terms, but that's what they said. But she said Joe Biden would come to the protests and he would never have his own sign. He would have to get somebody else, give me a sign, give me a sign. That to me sounds very reminiscent of current day the white people who will go out and pretend, and I want to make sure that I'm seen, I'm a part of this, here, give me a sign that I can hold, I'm down with the movement. You can't get a sign, you can't have someone on your staff to make a cardboard sign? Like, really? Get one of your children to make a sign for you? I got to go and snatch a sign from somebody and put up there, busing the Negroes, yes, I support busing the Negroes, yes. Lame. I've seen generations of that for a long, long time. Whether he wins or not, race soldier in the White House, but I said consistently, FOMO years. Let's see. The segment about the Kentucky Derby, like I said, I hope folks, or at least my explanation in terms of them linking the killing of Breonna Taylor, this black female in her own residence, with this horse race. That whole segment I just found tacky and disturbing for many reasons. Victim of racism, this black male jockey, like, I really didn't care, VGQ, if he wants to race or not. I thought a lot about white validation, like, man, participating in really any of these sporting events, white validation, and I mean the Kentucky Derby would have to be really high up there in terms of white validation. I wouldn't care if my whole family had participated in the event for the last, you know, 100 years or however long that they've had it. I thought it was even more important, were any of the white jockeys asked to sit out? I thought it would have been even better. How about all of the white jockeys? We will protest. We will abstain from riding, and then it can be the one black jockey. You race and win, and that'll be our protest. So we'll have a black winner, and all the white jockeys, we sit out because racism, white supremacy is a problem. That is, I feel like that's the way we should be thinking about this. Not, uh-oh, we got an albino coon, and we got a horse-riding coon. Why didn't you drop out, coon? And, VGQ, I don't care if he rides or not. Like I said, I do think that's white validation to be that vested in this event and hanging out with a whole stadium full of race soldiers in Kentucky. But whatever. VGQ, as I said, victims guaranteed qualified. Let's put the attention back where it should be. Get these other white jockeys in here. Why are you racing? What are you doing about all this? What are your thoughts on Breonna Taylor? Did you hear they stick the dogs on them? Bam, bam, question, question. How much? If you win, donate the purse to Breonna Taylor's family. Whole line of questions. Why don't you get some of the white jockeys on and ask them? Trifling, that's what I would expect. Even north of the border, global system of white supremacy racism. Can't even pin that on the American fake news, because that was north of the border, as they say. Speaking of which, for this broadcast, if we could be specific about metaphors, use of words, not using metaphors. There were a number of them in the segment Hot Button Issue. That's what they called so-called busing in the 1970s, whatever that means, a hot button issue. Be specific about what it is that we want to say. Race soldiers, they will use metaphors like that. Master deceivers. Part of a main component of our work as attempted counter-racists is to be precise, specific with words. We have been greatly influenced by race soldiers in a non-constructive manner with the use, reckless use really, of metaphors. Sometimes we're still learning. We don't have logic to articulate our views. We will substitute a lot of analogies, comparisons, metaphors. Be precise, exact with what we want to say. I will prompt about the metaphors. Much obliged. Let's see. Again, if folks have thoughts on the election, what you think is going to happen, who will be victorious, feel free to give a thought there as well. The number is 720-716-7300. The code 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. Let's see. First few folks who dialed in with a hand up, if you have comments, observations to share, line should be open. Feel free to hop in, share your thoughts.
Can I be heard?
Greetings, retired firefighter.
Greetings, Gus. Greetings to everyone that's on the line. DCS mentoring program has had a parent meeting. The parent meeting precedes the first day of another series of sessions for the DCS program. Once again, it's going to be at the public high school where the other sessions in the past have been. This is now the fourth year. It started in 2016. It's a pretty good meeting with the parents. Basically, just a situation where we introduced ourselves and Mr. Clark went over different rules and regulations, what to expect to the parents, the attempted parents. We'll get started, I believe, next Saturday. My thoughts on the election. I actually have a some sort of a question. There's always been this saying that non-white black people are the group that makes the final decisions on elections, and that's becoming more and more confusing to me in understanding that from the standpoint that in terms of white people and non-white people who are racially classified as black, we are a very small number. And even within that number, there is has been a growing percentage of non-white black people who actually have voted Republicans. One thing I have noticed, which is a large burgeoning group of people, and a lot of them are racially classified as white, it just so happens that their primary language is Spanish. And they overwhelmingly, especially where I'm sitting at right now in South Florida, overwhelmingly vote for the Republican candidates from a national level to a local level. And I think it's that way all over this part of the world that is conceptually called the United States, including from what I just recently heard a few days ago in Puerto Rico. So I would say my thoughts based on what I just said, not only that the present person in that position will retain his position, that it would probably, I would not be surprised if it would be in a overwhelmingly at an overwhelming level that is sometimes called a landslide. I wouldn't be surprised. Last but not least, while in the parent meeting, and this has happened to me, this is the third time that it has happened to me, that someone arbitrarily comes up to me and understand that I have just met the retired firefighter. It was apparent. I don't worry about anything as far as that's concerned. I could actually use my name, in the process, but I just go about it because, Gus, you identified me as a retired firefighter, and that is a part of a reality for me. So that's why I just go ahead and stick with that. But thought it was rather kind of humorous in a sense. but from that, to gather something scientific out of that, it indicates to me the potential proficiency of counter-racist codification, because that's what goes on this program. And in turn, I have noticed over not my entire lifetime, which is from what I was told, 62 years, but let's go over just 20 years, that people were not even using the term, or very rarely, racism, white supremacy. And now it's a common combination word in vocabulary that's being used. So I'm stating that it appears to be that there's an interest in a growing number of non-white people, non-white black people, to adopt a codified means of thought, speech, and action. And that's all I have to say. Thank you, everybody, for listening. Thank you.
How about that? Grand. Recognized, hopefully, for something constructive, retired firefighter. I have, to your question, I have heard that many times. I think that is an oft-repeated cliche around election times, particularly, I would say, like presidential elections, the U.S. presidential election, that the vote will be decided by black voter, or the election will be decided by black voters, or the power of and influence of the black voter to sway an election. Like, I will hear a lot of that, and none of it, just trying to follow logic, as was mentioned. None of that makes any sense to me at all. If we are in a system of white supremacy racism, in fact, the report that we played about the Sunshine State, where he's sitting at specifically, they just said, now, we had so-called Democratic vote, and the citizens of Florida said, all right, felons, we will restore your right to vote, right on. We'll let you participate and all that good stuff. And they said, well, now that we think about it, we'll let you do so after you've paid all your fines off. So if that takes you another 20 years, well then, you know, I guess we'll have to wait till 20 years. Maybe we'll have electronic ballots or you can vote by your phone by then, but we'll see what, maybe you can stay out of trouble for 20 years, then you'll be able to vote. Even if you do, are able to vote, you don't even know if they count it or not. They had the reports in 2016 about black voters being purged from the rolls. That was the term that they were using specifically, purged from the rolls. And states that were saying, like Ohio, which they'll say is a so-called battleground state. So, I mean, in a system of white supremacy racism, Pamela Evans Harris, she used to say it all the time, we can't even verify for sure if they're going to count our vote, much less sway the election by, you know, the sheer number of black people who go to. I mean, it just doesn't make sense. No aspect of it. I don't know if the African Liberation Army, I don't know if they're going to go and intimidate everybody at the Electoral College. And, you know, you're going to vote for Obama for a third term right now. Or, I mean, maybe that's going to happen. I've never seen that. I don't know. But a lot of rhetoric and non-logic is tossed around during election time. Let's see. Much obliged, retired firefighter. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, if you have commentary to share, line should be open. Proceed.
Can I be heard?
Greetings, Mo in Dallas.
Greetings, Josh. Thank you. Greetings, listeners and callers. As far as my views on the upcoming election, I too understand that, in my opinion, that America is just the nation as a whole seems to be more comfortable with overt white supremacy as opposed to covert white supremacy. That's just my opinion. And that is white and non-white people. I think it actually makes, in my opinion, white people less comfortable than non-white people, because non-white black people are so common we understand that racism is a common element in our lives, and I'm not saying that white people don't know that racism, white supremacy is a common element. I think that they're uncomfortable with the fact that we're comfortable with it, or some are. So I think those are the guidance supporters. I think the majority of the country understands that we are going to have 4 more years of Donald Trump. But that's just an opinion. I was surprised that you played the Breonna Taylor news interview until I did hear the dogs, and when I heard the dogs, because I know you were so adamant about not playing, you know, things of that sort, and I was like, oh, dogs, there it is. So it just made sense, and I also wasn't aware of those dogs, and I would like to say that Mr. Walker was lucky that the dogs didn't get released on him. He could be a totally different person. I know he lost someone very important to him, but he is, I guess, fortunate that they weren't as cruel as they could have been. I thought it was very interesting the way he was treated, or the way he said he was treated after the shooting, you know, him being taken out of handcuffs and allowed to use the restroom and get water. Those are torture techniques that they usually, you know, subject victims of racism to. Even when they're innocent, you know, they'll race soldiers and law enforcement will leave you handcuffed, knowing you have to use the restroom. They'll put you in cold rooms. They'll handcuff you to a table. So him describing the way he was treated in police custody was very interesting. So I do appreciate the segment. This is to a retired firefighter. Believe it or not, sir, you have a lot of admirers. The Cows does. I was an admirer, long time admirer before I decided to call in and actually, you know, consistently participate. But a lot of the consistent callers, you have a lot of admirers, and they appreciate the degree of logic that everyone uses, especially Gus, B in Toronto, Thomas in New York. But retired firefighter, your voice is so, like, permeating, like, it gets the attention, and it suits the logic that you execute, sir. So we appreciate you. That's all I have for now. Thank you, Mimalon.
Much obliged. Mo in Dallas, follow logic. Very important. Follow logic. If anything, if counter-racism encourages victims of racism, be able to follow and, hey, I can compute logic myself and share logical information with other victims of racism, we will be very prompt in getting this problem solved. That is one thing race soldiers do not want to see, lots and lots of black people getting really serious about using logic and logic as it applies to ending, replacing white supremacy racism. I didn't know any about that. The dogs with the police segment. Didn't know anything about that. How he was treated. That was all news to me. Like I said, I don't follow the police, you know, report thing. So I didn't know if all of that information had come out in the previous months or was that recent information. But yeah, the dogs. Other folks who dialed in. If you have a hand up, commentary to share. If we have missed you totally. Line should be open. Proceed. Well, I give folks a opportunity to get their thoughts together. We were going to be doing the Global Sunday Talk tomorrow. That was the plan, but I got a little bit off schedule because I didn't get my computer replaced until like the middle of the week, so I was a little uncertain if I would be ready to roll by Sunday, so I did not get everything prepared for the broadcast tomorrow. So by the time I kind of realized, like, ooh, this is last minute, as they say. This has not been planned in adequate time to execute the program as we normally would. I said we should just wait and do this next Sunday. So that will be the plan because I do want to talk with our folks in different parts of the world about the election and the COVID-19 restrictions. Like, I am not sure about here in the U.S. I guess it depends on where you live, but in, like, they have a 9 p.m. curfew in Paris. Now, the Boogaloo people might be out at the Eiffel Tower and all the rest, but I haven't seen that yet. 9 p.m. curfew in Paris. The last time we had our Global Sunday Talk, many of our listeners, they said there were massive fines. They said, I think the fines were like thousands of dollars. You want to pull one of those Rona parties and we're all going to get together and drink and have fun and we'll just get the Rona and get it. $1,000 fine. Like, no messing around. We're taking it serious. Social distancing, put your mask on, stay at home, all the rest of it. Like, so I'm very eager to check in to see, you know, how are folks responding? Are they having militias, you know, power? We're not going to take this. You're not going to tell us to wear masks. We'll lynch you. Are they having that sort of thing happening, or are they, you know, complying peacefully in these different areas where this is happening? Like I said, I'm not, I guess it depends on where you are in the U.S. in terms of whether they're having restrictions, not having restrictions, is it being taken seriously? I will say quickly that segment about the doctors. So they had a black patient, seemed like she might have at least had some of the symptoms of COVID-19, and they talked about how she was treated. Now, they did insert that this was a non-white physician. That's not a surprise in the system of white supremacy. Everybody is conditioned to dislike, mistreat black people. Black get back. We talked about that. They didn't give that context in the report. But when they went on to talk, they went to unconscious bias. Why not just reference medical apartheid? That was an NPR report. They've interviewed Harriet A. Washington. You could, in fact, why not give her a call? I'm sure she would have been happy to give 5 minutes of time to offer some of her expertise and give a plug for the book. Medical Apartheid, Gus T's Top 10. Dorothy A. Roberts, Dorothy Roberts, she's been a guest on the program repeatedly, Killing the Black Body. Same thing, or at least a mention of, well, yeah, there is a long history of overt, direct medical racism in a variety of different races. They could have even went the white racist route and got Rebecca Skloot on, Henrietta Lacks. Like, there's lots of different layers and generations of white medical terrorism, this sort of flagrant mistreatment of black patients, and why this sort of thing continues to happen. And this is probably exacerbating all of the data that has been given for the last, 7-8 months about how bad black people and non-white people are afflicted with COVID-19. That would have been a much more accurate, logical context to explain that report, as opposed to it was some non-white doctor with unconscious bias who mistreated a black patient. Like, really? Racism, white supremacy in journalism, in my view. Other folks who dialed in, if you have commentary to share, *61, if you would like to participate. Not for spectators, once again, especially if you have thoughts on the election.
Can I be heard?
Thomas, in New York, yes, sir.
Good evening, Gus. Good evening to all the callers. The Los Angeles Lakers, or should I say the Los Angeles niggers? That lady was never fired, by the way. Jerry Buss purchases the team for a whopping $67 million in 1979, which included the Lakers, the Kings, the hockey team, and the L.A. Forum, I think, which is in Inglewood. And he sold that in 2012 for $23 million. But his children, they inherit a team worth $4.4 billion. Talk about something that grew in value in my lifetime. And the hockey team is worth $850 million now. So I say that was a pretty good investment. All built on the backs of black males, Kareem and Magic, Shaq and Kobe, now LeBron and Anthony Davis. As far as the trophies, that made me think, Gus. It was Georgia Fontieri. She was the owner of the St. Louis Rams. She grabbed that Super Bowl trophy and hugged it. Dick Vermeule had to wrestle it out her hands. And of course, you can't forget Frillo Marge shot, confirmed racist. She held that World Series trophies up with her sons. I suppose they were her sons. So, yeah, very good observation. Kenneth Walker, the poor guy, met by guns and dogs. I thought you added the dog barking in, but I guess not. He said he was dragged down the street wet and barefoot with rocks and glass and stuff going in his feet. PTSD. He's going to have that forever. Whether he had a criminal record or not, I didn't get the point of the journalist adding that into the conversation. That wasn't relevant. The metaphor I guess they use for this is perfect storm. System of white supremacy, no knock warrant, open carry state, police busting, someone shoots at the police shoots back, kills someone. Now, if someone breaks your house, you have the right to shoot. And if police are serving a warrant, they have the right. Procedure tells them that they should return fire. In the system of white supremacy, this is how it works. The only thing that can be done at this point is to make the police liable, is to prove that the search warrant was obtained unlawfully, or that the search warrant was obtained by some type of coercion with confidential informant, bad information, things of that nature. That's the only things that can be done. I didn't get how this militia group that went to kidnap a sitting governor who is white for face masks, and for them having to wear face masks, for them her closing the businesses and schools and gyms, et cetera, how this becomes a racial incident. What does this have to do with us? So we don't have the power to enforce any of this stuff. Black people, what black people have these militias going after? Like, I don't hear any reports where these white militias are in Detroit kicking down doors or Flint, you know, pissing in the water. Like, I don't really see why the news is trying to tie this into somehow something that has, you know, this is to me white obfuscation. You know, you want to obfuscate away from the point and somehow inject racism where it's not necessary. The Holocaust. I don't get what false claim. The official number now is 6 million people. It has changed 3 times officially over the years. The Chicago Tribune put out an article in 1992 called Fixing the Numbers at Auschwitz. You could Google that. In this article, they say the actual number is between 1.1 million and 1.5 million, with at least 90% of those victims being Jews. So how can you, can anyone find an encyclopedia from the 50s or 60s that talks about the Holocaust that gives you the 6 million number? Absolutely not. So I don't see how, and mind you, this thing happened in the 40s. It wasn't like this happened, you know, like we're talking about the slavery numbers, like, you know, this happened in the 40s. So I don't see how Facebook could enforce this. What gives them the authority? You know, this is the number. No one could prove whether the number is right or wrong at this point. You know, or how can we dig up the graves and tell that this white person is a Jew and that one's not? It's impossible. So it's just a waste of time, and I don't think they should have the authority to do that. Twitter CEO Jack Dorsey, he's been told to come to Washington ASAP to explain why they're banning people from posting a New York Post article last week that was exposing some of Joe Biden's emails and proved that him and his son may have done some illegal transactions or used their influence and things of that nature in the Ukraine. Now, to kick the people off for retweeting a New York Post article now, like, this is Twitter. Like, this is the oldest newspaper in the country. You know, this was a story that was documented, referenced. I say good journalism. They went through the editing process at the New York Post and it was put on the front page. Like, I don't see how Twitter can kick people off for putting out a story that is, who gives them the authority? I did have something to say about the election. I know I'm running slow on time, so if time permits, I'll come back. The last thing I say is Atlanta police used a drone to arrest a man suspect for murdering Thomas Jefferson Byrd, who's an actor that appeared in several Spike Lee movies. These drones have heat signature sensors, facial recognition, and gesture recognition technology, microphones and speakers so they can hear you and talk to you. They're like flying smartphones. They use this to actually go into the apartment, engage the person, get him to come out, make sure he didn't have any weapons with his hands up, and follow him out as the police arrested him, probably with guns and dogs. But this is where we're going in the system of white supremacy. I'll read my line. Thank you, guys.
Oh, man. Much obliged, Thomas in New York. It doesn't make it any better. This is, I can quote the great Toni Morrison, this is change without improvement. So I think I just didn't hear Thomas in New York accurately when he was sharing the information about the drone use, which is so critical. That's why I played that report about the use of having cameras and everything. Everyone will be, you know, on camera, and they'll have video of all this, like, and the cities where they're using this technology is so important. Like I said, refinements. They refine the MacBook Pro. They refine surveillance in the system of white supremacy. They don't have the grainy footage like they did Rodney King early 90s. So I just didn't hear him correctly, and I thought he said that Thomas Jefferson Byrd was arrested, and that's not what he said. It's Thomas Jefferson Byrd was fatally shot. It's like, oh man, that's not any better at all. They did use drone footage in this. Let's see. The man not. We know black males die. Yes. Let me make sure I get the drone coverage, because they do have that. Yes, they do have that. That was one of the first reports up. All right, so this is from The Independent, a UK publication. Suspect in murder of actor Thomas Jefferson Byrd arrested by police drone flown into his apartment. Atlanta police. Woof. Atlanta is the worst plantation, or it's one of the worst. I'll put it that way. It is one of the worst. It is one of the worst. Flint's got to be up there, any place where you can't drink the water. But man, there was a reason Gusty had to flee Atlanta. My apologies to any of you all who have to, not my apologies for what I said, my apologies that that's where you have to reside in the system of white supremacy. Anyway, Atlanta police used a drone to arrest a male suspected of murdering Thomas Jefferson Byrd, an actor who appeared in several Spike Lee films. The Atlanta Police Department shared the dramatic video footage on Twitter. What? In the video, the drone enters the suspect's apartment after the entrance is blown. So they used explosives and a drone. It appears to survey the inside before the suspect walks out from a back room with his hands up. So I guess if I had to choose between, you could have armed white men and their dogs, or explosives and a drone. White men with guns and dogs, explosives and a drone. I'll say what I just said. The late Toni Morrison, change without improvement. The bluest eye. That is horrendous. Like, I can't. Thomas Jefferson Byrd.
Gus, can I say one more thing to that, please?
Yes, sir.
They also have robot dogs. to spot any dogs. So, walking around telling people, put on your mask. It's just a matter of time before they send that into the apartment once they weaponize it a little bit more. It's sort of like the dog in Black Mirror. If you recall, when Micah Johnson was allegedly killed the police officers in Dallas, they sent in a robotic, this drone had wheels or tank wheels that rolled in, found him, and then exploded itself and killed him. And that was, what, 2006, 2005, 2015, I think, 14. So they're doing it.
Much obliged, Thomas in New York. Strive for accuracy. Unless my memory is in error, I believe that was 2016, because that was a part of how our current commander-in-chief got the office. I think that was right before he did the Republican National Convention and officially accepted, because the Philando Castile and Alton Sterling shootings were just before that incident. But yeah, they used the, we talked about that with Dr. Niana Rossayan. I thought that was way more important than the other aspects. Like, yeah, this is not the first time the drone and the explosives have been used on. They don't do this for white people, right? They didn't do this for Jeffrey Epstein. You can go and rape white children, like be a serial child rapist, and they don't break the drone out to come drag you in and all that. They don't even break the dogs out if you're a serial child rapist. Like, we'll get to them. We'll get to them later. We got other black people to chat. The coons. Coons. The number is 720-716-730. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Atlanta. Ugh. Can you? I can tell you, as someone who has resided in Seattle for more than a decade, I cannot imagine the response of white citizens here if they decided to start using drones to and explosive to burst into people's residence. Come on. Talk about militias. Come on. Let's see. Other folks who dialed in, if we've missed you totally, proceed.
May I be heard?
Greetings, caller in Florida.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much, sir. Greetings to Gus, the host, the listeners and callers. As far as the election, I'm definitely thinking it's going to be the president going to win. I'm not sure how much it's going to be by, but I just have a feeling also that the what they call the so-called right-wing groups, I don't know if one was called QAnon or whatever, a lot of groups of white people like that becoming more emboldened, aggressive, vicious, and along with the like Black Lives Matter supporters. And I think that's definitely been infiltrated by racists. So a lot more obfuscation and confusion in that. It was a metaphor that I had caught where the, I think that was a victim, where they were talking about the busing. She said, if you can stand there long enough for the crumbs, you'll get the whole cake. I don't know if you heard that one, but that was a new one to me. Kind of like a food metaphor there. As far as the here locally, the Florida Gators football team, they had 22 players test positive. So the team was supposed to play LSU today, but the game was canceled. And also, updating the day, Dan Mullen, the coach, tested positive as well. He wanted to pack the stadium. So the president said, no, they were going to keep it reduced attendance. So at the middle of the week, they pretty much just canceled all the sport activities. But I predicted that pretty much will happen anyways. I also heard the president use that code word, suburban women, will you vote for me? I saved your damn neighborhoods. So a lot more rhetoric like that I can see being prepared to be on display. And other than that, that's all I have to share right now. Thanks for allowing me to share.
Much obliged, caller in Florida. I forgot there were so many. You can't play, you know, every news report. I say that each week because there's just so many reports and different things that come out week to week, so it's hard to kind of keep up with everything. But there was a report from NPR where he continued with the rhetoric. I have to see if I can find it to see if we can include it before the program concludes. But the metaphor, I do recall her saying that. I think that might have been a victim. That was just audio, the report about the busing and all. But if you stand there long enough for the crumbs, you will get the whole cake. I've never heard that before either. I have no idea what that means. If anyone would like to explain, or if you have experienced that, where you stood there for the crumbs, a slice of the cake, a piece of the icing, and you ended up getting the whole cake, well, then you can, you know, break it down for us. But yeah, I'm a little bit ignorant. And as I said, I'm generally very, that's why this here broadcast, please, no metaphor, because that happens. Sometimes it's just that I'm a little ignorant. I don't know what that means. You know, sometimes I think I know what they mean, but sometimes, yeah. The football man. So now we got brain damage and the Rona. Let's let the football go. Like, we could do many other constructive things with that time and energy, like fitness, teamwork, anything that, whatever football is supposed to do, whatever we're supposed to, you know, think is constructive, mentorship, bonding, social activity, whatever, opportunity to go to college. It's lots of other things we could do where we could minimize our risk for brain damage and the Rona. There are lots of other problems, but we'll just stick to those two for right now. This should totally be, I'm done with football. I don't even know if I want, like, watching football should feel some type of way right now. Like, really? I thought they just had, like, the NFL, they had to cancel and reschedule all these games because these athletes kept testing positive. Got to be a lot of black players. They say the NFL is, like, 60% black, even though that's not reflected in the coaching and ownership. But as Thomas in New York said, the horses, I'm using a metaphor deliberately because that's what they did talking about Breonna Taylor. I said I was offended. The horses of all of this, the black labor to generate these billions for the NFL owners and billions for the University of Florida Gators and billions for LSU in Louisiana, and they wouldn't take care of, serve a nickel for black people who died during Katrina and even Alabama. That was Nick Saban, the white suspected racist coach at the University of Alabama, tested positive for the Rona this week. That's all the same football college. That is the glorious SEC where you got all of this happening. I mean, shut all this down. And they are notorious, again, the horses of the SEC, lots of black boys. Brain damage and the Rona. Most of them are not going to the NFL to get any money. We can let all that go. No need. Like I said, you should even feel some type of way watching football. Like, really? This is for me? Brain damage and the Rona, they're risking all that for me to sit here and cheer for any of these teams? Just saying. Unless I'm talking crazy. If I'm talking crazy, please, you know, speak up loudly. Other folks, if you have comments, questions, observations, proceed.
Hello?
Louisiana State University. Irie, yes, ma'am.
Hello, everyone. I just wanted to add something about dogs that I'm noticing. It appears as though white people really, really value dogs, and they do, especially for as a tool for policing. But it's interesting because one of the ways that they like to terrorize people, especially so-called indigenous people, is they'll kill their dogs, like, summarily. I remember a story from the island now known as Diego Garcia. It's located in the Indian Ocean around the Seychelles. And it was first taken over by the United States Navy and then basically gifted to Great Britain. And it's now called Paradise Island. But one of the natives there said that the first thing that happened when they wanted all of the original people to go was that they just went in without warning and killed all the dogs, because the dogs were like their one of their most treasured animals. You know, they, I guess it's like kind of how they say people in India feel about the cows. It was a sacred animal to them. So I just wanted to say, yeah, it's not so much that they really, really love dogs and everything. And, you know, it just depends on the situation. And if they know that the dogs are treasured by the people, they'll kill them, but then they'll also use them to maim and, you know, mess people up. Yeah, that was it, really. And I thought of that during the White Dog series, but I didn't say it. So that's all, and I hope everybody has a good night.
Much obliged, Irie. Interesting observation. Dogs are albino coons, dogs certainly are super valued in the system of white supremacy, so noting any changes in their relationship to those dogs, certainly important to make note of. Other folks that we have missed, the number again, 720-716-7300, the code 564-943-#. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. We have about 10 minutes left in the broadcast, so make sure you're not waiting until the last minute if you want to chime in, participate.
Copy, sir.
Yes, sir. Thomas in New York.
Yes, sir. You know, Amazon just came out with a Echo speaker that has a drone, Alexa speaker, I guess you call it, has a drone that comes out of it. So it works with their Ring doorbell system. If someone comes in or enters through one of the sensors, the drone just pops up and flies to the location to give you a visual of what's going on. And that's the new product they're coming out with. I think they said $129. It's a little drone, but it has a very high definition camera on it. As per the election, we have a person who's been in office for 47 years, 44 of them as a United States Senator and as Vice President. So when you go back and look at some of the earlier things, when Biden was the first co-sponsor listed on a bill written by Mississippi proud Democratic Senator Jamie Whitten, white supremacist, called the Comprehensive Crime Control Act in 1984, which started the metaphor war on drugs. And this brought in three strikes, increased sentence times, property forfeiture, they'll take your house or something. Like we needed that. We became criminalized, and states had incentives to invest in private prisons. 2 years later, Biden co-authored and co-sponsored with Senator from Massachusetts, Tip O'Neill, who used, because he was so upset because basketball player Len Bias died of a cocaine overdose, he decided that he was going to create this Anti-Drug Abuse Act in 1986. Now, mind you, Len Bias died of a powder cocaine overdose, but they created a 100-to-1 crack rocks or cocaine powder discrepancy or disparity. So 100 more times I'm a dude for having crack than cocaine. They broadened the scope of what they call kingpin charges. Just created billions of Nancy Reagan to walk around saying, just say no. This was like when I was a little child in school. I remember this stuff. Like you would open candy boxes and they'll have just say no on the labeling. They created the mandatory minimum and they criminalized money laundering. Just 2 years after that, Joe Biden co-sponsored, and now he's a part of the Judiciary Committee. In 1988, they strengthened the Anti-Drug Abuse Act. They call it the Anti-Drug Abuse Act of 1988, which includes the mandatory minimum and gave judges and prosecutors the ability to charge someone with these illogical sentences like 3 to 15. You know, like, how get 3 to 15? You know, I'm doing on 4 to 80, you know, and that was part of that. Then in the 1990, the Crime Control Act of 1990 created the deadbeat dad, the drug-free school zones, the gun-free school zones. So now if you get caught in an area, urban area mostly, where there's no way you could be out of a school zone, you get added sentences. And then, of course, we get the Crime Bill in 1994, which is called the Violent Crime Control and Law Enforcement Act. They knocked down the projects, created the prison industrial complex, gave police military weapons, created drug court, extended sentences longer. I mean, this is what this guy did in his career to black people. And then turned around after that and did the Patriot Act, which is why we have all the surveillance totally lawfully being done to us now with the drones and stuff. That's what is going to open the door for all that to happen. So I don't think Donald Trump is the law and order president. I think Joe Biden would be, especially when it comes to us. And I'll meet my line. Thank you, Gus.
Open the door metaphor. But he said money laundering. That was a big part of the crime bill and taking down the super predators and just say no and all that. Like, wait a minute. They just said, like, a couple days ago that all of this money laundering is billions. It might have been even higher than that, but it was so much that the stock market had trouble for a day. Like, wow, all of these illicit financial transactions, my goodness. Drugs and all the rest. We just played it. I just talked about that. The BBC, it was big news internationally. This was just within the last few weeks or so that they have not done any work. Substantially with regards to money laundering. That's why a number of these big banks have had to pay huge fines and what have you. They have not. If you want to talk about going out and snatching black people off the corner versus getting white people, individuals classified as white, who are responsible, I mean, really, if it's just say no, let's break the finances of all this. No, same thing. We can't seem to get those drones and all that and harsh sentences for the white child rapists and white money launderers. Let's just go to the coon. That's what all this is about. Incidentally, I did find the segment. Now, I think caller in Florida, we were talking about some of the rhetoric for the election from our current commander in chief. I did intend to play this, but I forgot. There were so many reports, and then that big segment on Breonna Taylor that I did not intend to play. I ended up playing, so a little discombobulated, but I did have this one as well. Now, just I'm not going to play the whole thing, but just listen for a second. This is talking about Thomas in New York was talking about the vaccines. Still not here, but they're talking about vaccines here.
This message comes from NPR sponsor HBO Max with 537 votes. An HBO documentary film chronicling the political machinations that led to the unprecedented contested outcome of the 2000 presidential election. From executive producer Adam McKay, 537 votes premieres October 21st on HBO Max.
Live from NPR News, I'm Lakshmi Singh. Pfizer, the apparent front-runner in coronavirus vaccine development in the United States, says its results won't be ready until mid-November at the earliest. NPR's Richard Harris reports that the delay is driven by the need for safety data.
Pfizer executives have been saying they could have results sometime in October, and that has bolstered President Trump's repeated claims of a COVID vaccine before Election Day. But the company has now revised its timeline. It says it could know whether its vaccine is effective by the end of this month, but it won't have enough safety data to proceed with a Food and Drug Administration application until the third week of November at the earliest. Polls show many Americans are hesitant about taking a coronavirus vaccine and concerned the approval process could be driven by politics. But vaccine companies say they won't let that happen, and Pfizer says its announcement underscores its commitment to safety. Richard Harris, NPR News.
In a look at how the U.S. economy is doing during this pandemic, we've seen a strong start to spending in the fall. NPR Scott Horsley has the government's latest snapshot of the U.S. economy.
Retail sales are...
I don't think that's the correct segment unless I misheard, but they included, they were talking about the virus, and so they cut from that, and they went to President Trump, and he was talking about how this is going to be administered, and he said we're going to have enough of the vaccine to combat the China virus. And I was like, wait, I thought, one, he said he was saying Chinese virus before, and I thought he had stopped saying that. Like, I hadn't heard him say that recently. I'm just like, is he? He's gone back to that again, but then I didn't get the correct clip. But I was not mistaken. He did call it. Did anybody hear that from this week, him calling it the China virus? Maybe I was the only one. He did say it. I did hear it.
No, he's been consistently calling it that since he's been on the campaign trail.
Okay. Yeah. I hadn't heard it as much as when he was rolling with Chinese virus before, but oh yeah, he was rolling with it. We're gonna have enough. The vaccine will be ready. Make sure we have a plan. We're gonna defeat the China virus. Go. It's like, what is going on? What is going on? Did any other folks have comments, observations that they wanted to share?
Hello?
Ivory.
Hello?
Yes, ma'am. We can hear you.
Okay, yes. It's a thought. It's a preponderance. But I just want to help people to kind of have in the back of their minds something that I'm wondering. I think they're refining their technology to be able to identify people, with faces covered. So don't do anything stupid, please. Stay codified. Even though, your face is covered, there is a such thing that we talk about on the program called biometrics. And I'm noticing certain checkout kiosks, especially like at Target right now, have the cameras that are, zoomed into people's faces. So I'm going to assume that they might even be getting biometric reads from people's heat signature, who knows, eyes, whatever they get out of people's retinas and everything. And I know that people may feel they have some type of anonymity or whatever to do things right now when it comes to having your face covered, but this is a system of racism, white supremacy, and they don't believe in us having secrets like that. So, that was the only thing I wanted to add. Thank you. Have a great night. Hotel.
Important point. I don't think any of us should have any assumptions of anonymity. Race soldiers have increasing methods of being able to identify folks and are looking at even more technology. One, I just wouldn't be involved. I think Mr. Fuller says, stand by your work. I wouldn't be involved in any activities, or maybe there should be some long thinking before being involved with any activities where you might feel I need to conceal my identity about this. Like, maybe you should really consider if this is worthy of being involved with to begin with. Any other folks before we get ready to conclude? Anybody we missed totally?
Can I be heard?
Retired firefighter?
Yes, I just also would like to document on the improvement of robots, the robotic technology. I was actually involved on an emergency call back in the mid to late 1980s of a more primitive version of a robot. Essentially what it was a shopping cart, and tied on the end of the shopping cart was a 12-gauge shotgun, a Remington shotgun. Reportedly a black male on the second story of an apartment complex inside of a apartment was shooting all through the night, and they had to evacuate the entire complex, and we were called in to the call to raise our hydraulic ladder to distract this black male, and in turn law enforcement was going to go in and kill him. Then they used this, their first attempt was with this quote-unquote robot. Like I said, essentially what it was a shopping cart with a 12-gauge shotgun on it, and it had, you know, the remote control like what they do with the model airplanes, the person that was operating the thing. Unfortunately for the robot, and fortunately for the black male, the wheeled apparatus could not climb stairs. Made it up to about two or three of them and couldn't go any further. But what got him out of the apartment was simply calling his dear old mom Willie, get on down here, boy. No, I mean, I'm kind of like joking about that part, but she might have said that. I don't know. But essentially, that's how he came out of the apartment. And that was something like maybe 12 hours after the fact that he started shooting. And, yeah, I'm reminded of that every time I hear people talking about the technology. That's it.
Fascinating. The context of white supremacy gets better all the time. The technology of white supremacy racism. The canines are a part of the technology of white supremacy racism. The biotechnology, biopower, I think that's the language that we used. We were talking with Dr. Tyler Perry this July when he was on the program. That is pretty much 3 hours. I don't think it's anybody we missed totally. Yeah, I didn't think so. All right. Much obliged for everyone's participation. Hope it was worthy of your Saturday evening. As I said, we should have been on for the Global Sunday Talk tomorrow, but the computer chaos and everything kind of discombobulated me enough that we will delay and just do it next Sunday so I can adequately prepare and get everyone all lined up to broadcast. We'll hear their thoughts on the election as well as the, like, man, I think they have got really, like, serious lockdowns in lots of areas. Or we'll see directly. We'll see directly. We'll ask, you know, what you know, type of restrictions have been implemented, if it's having an impact on their quality of life or, you know, how they organize their day. But we'll do that next weekend. In the meantime, we are back to our regular schedule. Have my computer, can broadcast, modem is corrected, excited to broadcast. So you can just check Black Talk Radio Network, the Facebook page. We will get cracking. White guests only. Looking forward to broadcasting right up through the election. We will see what happens with, yeah, we'll see what happens with all that in November and take lots of notes, make observations en route. Sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. Man, race soldiers, they always look to abuse and mistreat, manipulate, lie to non-white people. We need our brain computers working at maximum efficiency to solve this problem. In addition to being sober, let's be buckled. I still say, race soldiers, the Rona, militias, voter registration campaigns, lots of reasons to hunker down right now. Like, man, if you can, just stay in the house, work remotely, whatever else it is. Stay in your residence. That would be best. That's what I'm doing. If you have to go out, be super alert. If it looks like, you know, somebody is being rowdy, loud, this outing is done. Like, get to a safe location pronto. Like, this is nothing to play with. We're not having these sort of verbal confrontations with strangers, white or non-white. You should be thinking, if this is a white person, this white fella, this white woman could have a gun. Their white friend, their white homies that I see or maybe I don't see may also have guns. And I, as I said, this excursion is done. Getting to a safe spot, and we'll try this again at another time. But be really alert, super, you know, checking out your surroundings. Anything looks suspicious, not taking any risks this year. If, as I said, you got to go out. This is something serious, work-related, whatever. You are sober. You are buckled. If you're driving, you are not on the cell phone. Just number one, got to be vigilant, checking the surroundings, see what's happening. And then two, trying to minimize contact with race soldiers. Any small thing we can do, not on the phone, buckled, sober, minimize contact with race soldiers, badge or no. That's it. Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my condition.
Mm-hmm.
Even my conditioning has been conditioned.